Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It is 2:15, and I don't know where some of our members are, still having late lunch, but I think we can continue. Honorable Panlingan, you will convey the message. You want to phone them? Then we must wait another 5 minutes. The NCOP is not part of the city. It's only the NA. That's also a good thing that we can have made a correction there, because, and I'm not putting anything to you, but some people think that Parliament only consists of the National Assembly. Mr. Essinger, they think Parliament only consists of that house over there. But no law can be passed without the NCOP. Then it's not the Parliament. No. We are in terms of the Constitution, both of us have the same powers. It's also just the entities. I mean, Sauga is supposed to know that a councillor. So that's why sometimes we have joint committees. That's why sometimes we have joint committees with our counterparts on the other side as well. Instead of having departments camping on the doorsteps of Parliament, and when we go out for the oversight and ask them, why haven't you, they say no, but we have to be more in Parliament than being on the ground and deliver. I think let's proceed. I really apologize for this, but I think, some people had lunch meetings as well and all that. But, Honorable Salingan, if you haven't got a question, then I think public enterprise can carry on.
Thank you, Chair, and good afternoon once again to the members and the colleagues. Chair, my name is Matiesi Mukulu. I'm the Deputy Director General in the Department of Public Enterprises, responsible for legal governance and risk in respect of all the 8 state-owned companies within our portfolio. Chair, thank you for inviting us so that we can come and share our views on this issue. And I think as we will take you through the presentation, you'll also have an appreciation that from DPE, the way we've looked at it, we've also looked at it holistically, even though we did zoom into specific issues relating to Transnet and Eskom and Infraco in particular. I'm joined by my colleague, Melanchthon Makobe. He's the Chief Director, also responsible for legal and governance. And we also have Sandile Dlamini. He's also a Chief Director. And we were happy that we could actually kill 2 birds with 1 stone, because in the morning we were also in a briefing with our portfolio committee. Chair, I think just our presentation really, it's not going to be long, given the fact that a lot of issues have been covered. And just to give you a sense of what we'll be covering, I've decided to go in an approach where I just use two slides, just to give this house, especially given the fact that it's our first time, at least me in particular, my first time presenting to this committee. Just in brief, to look at the role of the state-owned companies in the developmental state, and in particular talk about the infrastructure development and their industrial development mandate. And this is important because as we go down, you'll be able to see how this issue of non-ferrous metals is important in terms of affecting negatively on the mandate of the state-owned companies. And then I will also touch briefly on our role as the shareholder in light of the state-owned companies governance, and in this case, just how we strike the balance between the SOC mandate and national interest, and in particular, when they approach us for strategic intervention like they did in this case. And then the last two parts that go into the substance of the issue will be covered by my colleague, Melaisten. But they will look at the impact of copper theft to Eskom and Transnet, and then share with this house just what we think are some of the proposed solutions. We've covered them in mainly one broad area, and that relates to the legislative amendments. Now, Chair, I think everybody is now faced with the fact that the role of the state-owned companies have changed, and the focus that the President has given in the State of the Nation's address around the infrastructure, it is clear that it requires a serious paradigm shift in the manner in which the state-owned companies do their business. Now, the way we looked at the state-owned companies within our portfolio is that really their core role is to provide strategic network infrastructure. And in this case, they needed to ensure security of supply, and you'll be talking in particular here in respect of Eskom, and to develop key industrial capabilities. And I think Transnet has come on board in terms of the partnering with a number of stakeholders to ensure this industrial capabilities. So broadly in our view, this mandate is this infrastructure and industrial development related. Now, government is the only social agent that, in our view, has an entrenched interest in ensuring adequate investment in infrastructure. And this, then it means we need to provide clear communication in terms of the strategic intent of how the state-owned companies are to achieve it. But then such investments, in our view, are also a prerequisite to sustaining the economy. But then you have this issue of copper theft, which is disruptive to that objective. And at the same time, when you link their mandate to industrial development, you'd find that the SOC spent a lot of money, and I'm glad some of my colleagues from Eskom and Transnet covered that area in terms of the maintenance costs are a serious drawback for them in terms of the maintaining the railway lines, and Eskom as well maintaining the infrastructure that is damaged as a result of the cable theft. So then, what do we have to do, we believe, as a shareholder, and in this case, shareholder being a generic to government, not only to DPE. We need to strike a healthy balance between the enterprise interests, because these entities are given a clear mandate that they need to be sustainable at the same time, ensure social development, and at the same time, they are national interest. And in our view, both of these objectives are seriously hampered where there is no strategic intervention by the shareholder being government, in terms of dealing with the problems that are facing state-owned companies. To that end, Eskom as Transnet have approached the department, and in this case, when we looked at their concerns around the issues of copper theft, what struck us was that it is not only them. When you look at the telecom, when they report the impact on their balance sheet. When you look at Centec as well, it's facing the same thing. And interestingly, Infraco would be covered as well. It may be into not directly or having the impact won't be the same as in Eskom and Transnet. But we've interacted with the company, and they're beginning to inform us that they're beginning to see serious impact to the company. And so our perspective was that the shareholder needs to provide strategic interventions. And this strategic intervention would not be driven by one government department. As DTE, we're not involved in policy-making space, but we believe that we've got state-owned companies that are affected. And to the extent that our sister departments would be able to provide that kind of a strategic intervention, we started engaging with them. And I think Melanchthon, when he goes in terms of the details of the proposals that we're putting on the table, you'll appreciate, Chair, that then we would need a consolidated approach as government, and then to ensure alignment as well and implementation of the proposals.
Thank you, Honourable Chair and Honourable Member. As a shareholder department, we received serious concern from Transnet, Eskom, and Infraco on the impact of cable and metal theft on their operations. They are really impacting negatively, as they've already indicated also in the morning, on their operations. Now, the non-ferrous metals, which is copper, aluminium, brass, stainless steel, and lead, so it's not only copper, but it's also these other metals, are core of the electric cables that transmit electricity, and also they have been used with the cables in the communication network and in the public transport, particularly in rails. So they are really very key for the provision of transport by Transnet, and energy by Eskom, and telecommunication by Infraco. So really the theft of these cables have a direct impact on the economy, the citizens, and the business. As we've already heard this morning, the SOCs have detailed security plans to try and deter copper theft. And some of them have actually had massive media drives to try and advertise in television and radio to try and dissuade people from stealing copper cables. But the main challenge is that copper is regarded as a lowly metal. And as a result of that, is a minor economic offense. And because it's regarded as a minor economic offense, the loss thereof is not thoroughly investigated, as it would be if it was a major economic offense. And the other challenge is that the numbers are increasing, respective of what the security plans these SOCs are putting in place and the media drives that they are having, the number of theft is increasing. Now, as a department, when we were approached by these state-owned companies, we looked at the way in which we can help to cap this problem. And we proposed that a legislative review be undertaken. Because if these people know that they are going to be punished harshly, then they will actually start engaging in these theft activities. And I'm going to go through the legislative amendments that we are proposing to make sure that there is harsher punishment for those that are found guilty of stealing cables. Firstly is the inclusion of copper in the definition of Precious Metal Act. Currently, the Act defines precious metals as gold, any metal of platinum group, and ores of such metal. But the Act also empowers the Minister of Mineral Resources to declare by notice any other metal to be a precious metal. So our proposal is that we include copper in the definition of precious metal. This will ensure that there will be harsher sentences for those that are found guilty. Because in terms of the Precious Metal Act, the maximum that you can get is 500,000 fine and 10 years imprisonment or both. So that is harsh enough to be able to deter people from engaging into this. In the morning when the generals were making
the presentation, they touched on the issue of the Second-Hand Goods Act and the regulations thereof. But the challenge with the Act is that not all the provisions of the Act are in place. So it's only certain sections that are applicable now, but the others are not yet in place. And one of those sections are those that are dealing with the issue of cable theft. Our proposal is that we understand that there's got regulations that deal with the accreditation of people who are dealing in these metals. But our proposal is that we need to have licenses, that these people need to be licensed to be trading in second-hand goods. And if they are trading without those licenses, and then it be a criminal offense. And also, if they have those goods, we must be able to say where they've got those goods from. And if they can't explain, let it also be a criminal offense. Because the current situation is that if you are in a position of goods and you cannot give an explanation where you get them from, you can get a fine or a 3 months imprisonment, which is very minimal. So we need something harsher than that to be able to deter those criminals. Some of those people who are stealing these cables are actually trading in them. Some of them are exporting them. So we are proposing the amendment of the International Trade Administration Act to ensure that trading or and exporting of copper is regarded as a serious economic offense. And as a result, it will carry harsh sentences and it will deter people from either exporting or trading in it. The other legislative amendment that we are proposing is the Miscellaneous Offences Act. To ensure that theft and illegal possession of these metals are covered by the Act and that strict and harsher punishment are imposed than currently are in terms of this Act. We also propose the amendment to the Criminal Procedure Act to criminalize any offence under any law relating to the illegal dealing or possession of precious or non-ferrous metals. So our proposal is that we have this holistic legislative amendments to be able to have very harsh punishment for those that are found guilty. And we think that if we have that, it will be able, one, to empower those judges and magistrates to give the highest kind of sentences and also deter those who are involved in these activities from continuing with them. The Department of Justice and Constitutional Development is not here, but we did approach them and speak to them about these legislative amendments that we are proposing, and they are in agreement with us that we can initiate these legislative amendments. And we are also in the process of engaging with the Department of Trade and Industry, the Department of Communications, the Police, and the Mineral Resources Department. And we are going to be forming a task team to make sure that all these legislations are amended to give effect to our proposals.
Thank you, Chair. Then, just to add then in closing, we are also mindful of the fact that a legislation amendment is a very tedious process, especially where now you're looking at a number of pieces of legislation. But we believe that at the end of the day, if you look at all these pieces of legislation, they reside within a number of departments. So it is only government that can actually implement and or at least initiate the process. We've seen criticism against government currently now with the Gautrain, where the mentality really out there is that government has been subsidizing this theft, because every time it happens, Eskom will budget, will secure money, Transnet will secure money, they will fix it. It will be an issue that they complain and they say it is an issue, but the fact of the matter is that government, the fact that government is not doing anything about it, then it means you have to live with the status quo. So we needed to deal with that, not only because we want to appease the private sector, but we believe that it's about time, especially given the fact that it is a growing industry, according to the research by the business industry, that it is a growing, and it's very lucrative. And you have to deal with this holistic legislative review, so that you don't deal with the small fish, but you start sending a message, and maybe drive the same campaigns that we're driving around the dealing the issues of the rhino horns. So with that, Chair, thank you.
Thank you very much, DPE, honourable members. Questions? Honourable Sinclair.
Chair, I want to thank DPE for this. I must admit that I think it's a presentation that once again reiterates the importance, but more importantly, get to the rest of the whole matter, and that is what are we going to do. And in terms of that recommendations for the proposed amendments, I think it's certainly a serious step in the right direction. But as the madam indicated, the big issue is, as he called it, the tedious part of that. Now, for us, this should have happened yesterday already. How swiftly can we move with this? Because I understand, Chairperson, that certainly from our discussions today, we will do some recommendations, serious recommendations, in terms of what are we going to take it forward. And I like the idea of the task team, but I would rather suggest that you even elevate it to an interministerial task team, that it gets to Cabinet as quickly as possible, that the draft legislation has been processed, and that it start the process.
Okay, TV.
Thank you, Chair. We note that, and we take it on task. I think the challenge that we've been having in the department is that how do you put all these departments together and drive this process? Because, as I said, we're not the custodian of any of this legislation. So you need first to engage and get this buy-in. And we've started with the Department of Justice. So I think in our plans and the project plans going forward, we'd have to see that we build in the inter-ministerial and make it elevated at the highest level.
Okay. Thank you very much for the presentation. We take note of that, and we'll also talk to our counterparts as well as in the National Assembly, as well as in NCOP, to see how we can assist in terms of getting the legislation off the ground. But thank you very much for the presentation and for your time spent and waiting, and we wish you well in your endeavors further ahead. EDD, Economic Development. The reason why I'm giving Economic Development before Energy was in actual fact that economic development is in actual fact the drivers of the interministerial task team. They are leading that task team. And it was probably maybe an oversight from our side. You should have given them the first platform. But in actual fact, you are getting the first platform on the solar water heater. That was not on solar water heater. So economic development will take us through solar water heaters, and then they'll be followed by energy, or SALGA before energy, SALGA, and then energy. Have you got a flight tonight? No, tomorrow. Okay, good. So you can spend and invest more in Cape Town. Economic development, Dr. Parker, welcome.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Good afternoon, everybody. My brief was to give you a sense of the the solar water heater program that's currently extremely topical. We've all heard about the intention to roll out 1 million solar geysers by 2014. So I hope I'll be able to give you a fairly good sense of what the progress is with regards to that implementation. And I hope also to address maybe some of the questions that were raised earlier in Andrew's or Eskom's presentation. Some of these slides are probably going to be a bit superfluous because you've seen them in Eskom in the presentation in some form or the other, and maybe OMPI has some of them as well, I'm not sure. But perhaps it's an indication that we are all working together to try and solve the problem, which is certainly a good thing. The solar water geyser is certainly a very important enabler. I mean, it's part of the Action Plan 7 from the Lakotla outcome, and it falls under the greening of the economy, which is under my directorate. And of course, the main objective I highlight was to scale up the financial support to achieve the 1 million solar water heaters by 2014. But a very important aspect of the rollout is to increase local production or localization as we speak of it. Around August the 24th, there was a cabinet memo raised in accordance with that, and all the departments started talking much more seriously about how we're going to implement this, where we're going to get the funding, but more importantly also, we started mobilizing our state-owned entities. The IDC, in the case of EDD, certainly in terms of its support towards small, medium, micro enterprise, and you know, to ensure that the exclusionary restrictions that may have existed previously, those barriers were removed. So we worked to try and unblock those. But there were other important areas identified within the cabinet memo, and certainly from the Lakotla, which pertains to not only localization, but you know, improved job creation and the whole issue around rural development. And cooperatives, as was mentioned earlier. So there is this steering committee that exists certainly under my DG's heading, and it's a multi-departmental team, certainly. Everything that comes out of there, I would expect, has been debated extensively. It's constituted of many of the core members as well as other departments, including, of course, the Department of Energy. And I think their particular roles and contributions will crystallize a little bit better when I do explain it. Science and technology is involved, public works, as well as higher education. Now, some of the main issues that became quite salient, certainly if one looks at, I think it was mentioned earlier, the ESCOM program that had existed, and going forward, some of the issues that needed to be tackled that were perhaps in need of some improvement. I mean, let's agree with that. And that was the localization aspect. There was the issue of provincial distribution. It's not acceptable that certain provinces benefit more than others. If you want to create a good spread and give opportunity to enterprises across all the provinces. But there's very tangible reasons for that. And I think Andrew alluded to that also. The Eastern Cape is known to be a very pivotal area for the manufacture and fabrication of low-pressure systems, certainly. And so it's one of the areas that certainly the municipalities were very aggressively engaging within the rebate program. Youth employment, but not only youth. I mean, we've reacquainted youth and employment because in our engagements with the unions, it's clear there's a large amount of reskillable or upskillable or retrenched workers out there that we need to address. The amendments to the regulatory framework, things such as designation that I will touch on, as well as new build and old build programs. So if you're building a new house, what are the implications from a renewables perspective? Because underpinning all of this is creating demand. And that's one of the reasons why you can bring in a geyser, a solar water system from abroad at $250 typically. So as opposed to locally where the numbers are twice or even thrice that in terms of cost. So, you know, one needs to address demand. And I think my colleagues after me will agree that just getting to 1 million geysers does not make demand. So we have to think beyond that. Because this is about the bigger picture. It's about creating an industry. It's not just about rolling out 1 million geysers. And then the set aside for cooperatives, the sustainability built into that, and specifically how it relates to installations. Some of the key recommendations of our PSC was that it is quite clear that the current rebate program, so the program that you've identified and you mentioned previously, you know, you get a guy to install your geyser and he makes you sign a document that says that you cede the rebate to him or he submits it on your behalf and he gets the ESCOM rebate, which is working, which works on a first-come, first-served basis. So there's a pot of money, certainly, and you're tapping into that. You know, the key strategic solution to many of the challenges is actually a move away from the rebate program. Let me add a disclaimer there, and you'll see this later on in my slides. You cannot paint solar water systems with the same brush. The low-pressure systems, it was touched on earlier, is a very different intervention strategically than would be a high-pressure system. The demands of the market are different. The pricing structures are different. You know, the economics of creating a sustainable industry is quite different, although the underlying technology has great similarities. So it is clear to us that the rebate program was structured and is more suitable perhaps to a particular class of solar water geysers. There is a very strong support to move towards the contracting model, and you've seen some of the operationalized aspects of it elucidated by ESCOM previously. And we feel that we support that as the PSC because we feel that it can create a lot of opportunity within addressing, you know, distribution issues, issues of bankability to make it viable because of the economy of scale, relatively speaking. And when you allocate large-scale contracts, you have the ability to leverage. A colleague of mine uses the phrase, you give the carrot with the stick. So I think it has the opportunity to allow you to do that, and we've got to leverage that ability and address a lot of the important things we've identified with it were perhaps, you know, not sufficiently addressed in the previous projects. Some key considerations. There is an important consideration, I've mentioned this before, and that is volumes. The size of the sector in other countries that are net exporters of this technology, whether, and it's not a mature technology, is at least orders of magnitude bigger than South Africa. So if this is going to be sustainable, we need to create demand. Roughly speaking, you know, the insurance industry within South Africa replaces about 400,000, give or take a few thousand, conventional units per annum. So that's the ones that you and I most likely have in our homes. How many of us have solar geysers here, you know? At a cost of around 3,500 to 5,000 rand per replacement, it varies per demographic because in Gauteng, the guy charges you 1,500 to 2,000 to replace it. In Cape Town, the guy is willing to do it for a grand. So, you know, there's that disparity there. So that's typically the size of the conventional market. But there is an admissible and a very important role for the insurance industry to play therefore within this. If insurance is willing to replace your existing geyser, the debate and the engagement centers around how can they help us to create demand in the long term with the replacement market. Because 400,000 is sizable, and that is growing still today. You have large companies, I mentioned them for the purpose of indication only, growing their ability to enhance throughput to 600,000 to 800,000 units per annum. So they have confidence that the market will continue to grow. This is a conventional geyser. The manufacturing processes are characterized by semi-automated processes. So this is not rocket science-y. You don't need billions of rands of investment in terms of the technology to manufacture in plates, laser cutting, sheet metal, plasma cutting in order to produce geysers. And in the case of convention, in the case of certainly your vacuum tube technology, then it becomes more complex. And in South Africa, we do not produce or manufacture evacuated tube technology. The installation processes are labor-intensive. They are driven primarily by manual work or manual installation. So there is an opportunity to create more jobs through the installation process, but again, for sustainability, it has to be a volume discussion. But if one compares the conventional sector, a conventional geysers, then certainly I think that the opportunity is immense for the solar water heater industry. Now, to give you again an indication, a low pressure solar water system could be imported into the country, and I use my squiggle there, it's approximately, because prices vary, around 2,000 Rand. But you would find typically that you could buy a well-priced one for about 4,000 Rand, a high pressure system, perhaps for around 5,000, but it would be selling to you, the man in the street, wholesale, semi-retail at around 13,000. So that gives you a sense of what you can import it at versus what you can source it at locally. The component costs in our initial studies that we have done within economic development varies by as much as 35%. Solar geysers made up of tubes, stands, tanks, etc. And at worst case, perhaps, you'll find that I could import a solar component at 35, even more in some cases, percent, cheaper than I could if I made it locally within South Africa. But that variation, there are many reasons for that. The one is perhaps the input costs related to labor. There is definitely an economy of scale argument there in terms of amortization. If you're producing for an export market of 100,000 plus units a month in some Asian countries. And of course, quality is a very important part. I mean, we pride ourselves here, though, for if our ES or EN classified steel is able to withstand high calcium content water in Kakamas or in the middle of Harib, then that is going to solve some of the concerns you had, ma'am, which was, you know, the quality of water. And a lot of the units that have stopped working, unfortunately, if they have stopped working, would be because of the quality of the material. But it is clear to us we need, concurrent with trying to roll out and a greater volume of geysers in the market, we need to stretch our buck, both as government and for the consumer. We need to push the price down of the initial capital acquisition. In other words, we need to make it reasonable for the man in the street without government intervention in suburbia to want to buy a 10,000 Rand high-pressure system or 12,000, which currently he can pay as much as 25,000, and therefore you think your return on investment is 8-9 years, it's not worth it. And, you know, the insurance industry is still not sure, are they going to be up your premium if they're going to replace your solar geyser versus your conventional one. So we need to push that price down to make it affordable. We also recognize that we need to change the way we contract, the way we roll out these projects. So the way we install them on the one side, or how we go about contracting with the installers and with the way we contract with the manufacturers. And that is why perhaps you saw Eskom speaking about, you know, not a turnkey, but rather a separate contract, one with the manufacturers and one with the installers. So you can try and leverage the relationship, because in our interactions with the sector, we've heard installers on the one hand complaining, you know, they make 500 Rand on a unit or 300 Rand on a unit. They are not the reason the prices are excessively high. It's the manufacturers, and then the manufacturers say, but we are giving jobs to the installers. So we're trying to address that. But it's very clear that the intervention strategy that we should support is a two-pronged one. There's no one brush or broad-spectrum antibiotic here. We need to have separate interventions. The low-pressure system is installed typically in low-cost applications, and as mentioned previously, it has a developmental agenda. Until now, it has tapped into funds that had a demand-side reduction or DSM management taste and feel to it. And that's wrong, because you cannot reduce the burden on grid power in the middle of Rimfasmark, which is a CRTP site, which is going to have 500 units, where the people didn't even have solar geysers or any form of hot water. So that is not demand-side reduction. That's a developmental agenda, socially. At the same time, our home, suburbia, we have existing 200, 400 liter geysers, which run at 6,000 watts, and there when you're replacing it with a solar geyser, you're definitely alleviating the load within the electricity demand. And you can see, you would have seen from the numbers that Andrew presented earlier, or Eskom, that there's at least a 30 to 70% split, 30% bias towards high-pressure systems, 70% towards the low-pressure system. But But that bias is also artificial. It's because we are pushing the low-pressure side within, as government. So, but it's a conundrum, honorable members and colleagues, because this is a very complex problem. It's complex not only because, you know, you're installing a geyser, but your intervention, your sources of funding is very different for the two, and the economies of scale is very different. One thing that was picked up, and I'm so excited by this, and it's something that we are going to address within the PSC, and we are. I mean, I just spoke to GCIS for the next meeting, is that we need to create a social awareness of solar water geysers. At the moment, you and I are nervous about spending 20,000 rand on a solar geyser because, as a consumer, we think about the spot capital injection we have to do now. With 20,000, I can, I don't know, do many other things except, or other than put in a geyser. But buy a television, perhaps, yeah. Put some new tires on your car, okay. But the thing is, we need to do a 49M type program where we need to create awareness within South Africa of the benefits of solar water geysers or solar water systems. And that is something we are going to pursue because you cannot look at this from an investment today. It's a life cycle type of thing. It pays for itself over an extended period of time and there are benefits within that. Just as you and I are conscious about changing LED bulbs, even within this room, the same way we need to create that kind of awareness about the benefits of solar water systems. That's going to help within the social awareness, the green awareness. At one of the stakeholder engagements, they said it must be a green revolution we must create. But certainly there must be a greater awareness campaign, and we are intending to do that. So addressing some of the more pertinent issues of localization. We surmise that an economy of scale contracting approach will allow us to stimulate localization much more than leaving the rebate scheme as is. In other words, you know, when you engage with companies and organizations to implement service providers to implement large scale contracts, you can leverage that. Concurrent with this, you may be aware of the designation legislation that has been tabled by the Department of Trade and Industry. Designation applies to subsectors or sectors where one is able, within a public procurement process, specify through the Minister of DTI, of course, he can designate that subsector or sector, and of course, therefore, the technologies within that for special consideration, be that changing the scoring it receives within the review process, be that in terms of the duties, be that for specific strategic support. And solar water geysers has definitely been identified for designation, and the DTI within the PSC has been tasked to finalize the designation process. And as I understand it at the moment, they have a consultant that is finalizing the economics of the argument. So what that means is that within a public tender process, that is state funding, if it's a locally manufactured geyser, you can actually now apply very specific criteria to assessing that particular project. And this is very important because, you remember, we work within a WTO friendly framework, and the last thing you want is being accused of import substitution and therefore violating all sorts of accords. So designation allows us to work around that. There is still a question of, and this is very clear within the low-pressure regime because we know that government supports the low-pressure rollout program. We've heard that Eskom says they will continue with the rebate program and the high-pressure system, but at the moment there's no envisaged large-scale rollout, such as the low-pressure. So therefore the question is, can we apply it to the designation to the high-pressure systems? And that is a question that's being answered and addressed within the legal framework. The creation of demand and the awareness across all spheres of users and households is very important. I've been doing that. You may be aware that at COP17, this million geyser rollout program was considered a legacy program within the UNFCCC precinct, and it was designated as one of the top 10 projects. So it's receiving a lot of attention. And we actually find a lot of companies international also now coming and saying, how can we participate in how geysers SABS approved, etc. There's been a lot of stakeholder engagement within the NEDLAC framework, certainly within our department. When you look at the energy efficiency campaigns with business, We have, as EDD, we have the new growth path, which talks about this, and then that has subsequently led to the Green Economy Accord, the Green Jobs Accord, which extensively talks about the opportunity that solar water geysers as an industry represents for South Africa. So, again, beyond the 1 million. How do we address the even provincial, the provincial distribution? There is a skew there, but the idea is with large-scale batch installations, we can address this almost immediately, and we're expecting that we can allocate equitable distribution through an FFC model, and at the next PSC, the Department of Energy will come, will present that distribution. We also expect that this should address the rural development aspect of it, and rural development land reform is certainly part of the committee, and their role is to try and see how they can ensure that access to CRDP, those Mkondo, Muyeshe, those which is in Limpopo, Bochum, all those outlying areas, because we're talking about social development as well, is addressed. Demarcation of the beneficiaries. In terms of further designation, because we don't decide names and faces, is certainly something that is being done and will be done with SALGA and other departments. I think this provincial distribution and this large-scale approach towards this intervention will help us also to manage some of the quality assurance and the after-sales issues that we definitely need to approve on based on previous work. Youth and unemployment. In our engagement with labor as well as with the Department of Labor, there's a database that exists with contact details of retrenched employees within the various sectors, mining, chemicals, etc. And we expect that database we will make available to potential contractees so that they can access that, because there is an apparent gap within the installation market in terms of qualified plumbers to be able to install these systems. So this is how we expect one aspect of youth and employment address. We are working with the Department of Higher Education to train the artisans, for example, Cape Peninsula University of Technology. Tswana University of Technology has got international agreements with various international institutions within the EU, within Asia as well, and we're expecting that hopefully we can facilitate more technology transfer than a buy and sell relationship. And also we know that CP2, for example, is setting up a competence area where people can become technically qualified in solar water system diagnostics and installations. The Department of Science and Technology has been tasked within the steering committee to assist us well with the technology development, but this is more medium to longer term. If we recognize that the high pressure systems requires a different type of interventions that are geared towards bringing the price down, addressing the technological issues that will give us, South African companies, an opportunity to even export these products, then there's work for TSC to be done. And so their role is their particular role within the steering committee is to roll out several technology development programs from within the CSR and certainly within the various universities of technology. Funding is, of course, a very important part. This slide is perhaps a little retrospective, but Eskom was granted the 1.1 billion, and it took us to around 230,000 units as it stands roughly today. But we need to get to financial year 15, certainly, and so there's a requirement for almost 3 billion funding to be able to fill that gap. And that's what the slide means or tries to address. If you're also going to couple with the funding of installing the geysers, funding for development of SMMEs, funding for economic development of installers and companies and universities, then you need to look for other sources of funding, which is, of course, sources of funding coming from the Jobs Fund, the Employment Creation Fund, CRDP funding. if they still have funds within that, certainly. The Green Climate Fund, we put it there, but at the moment it's a bank account that's still empty. It's a UNFCCC-inspired one, as you're all aware, from COP17. And then the IDC as well. The IDC is quite aggressively involved with helping to upscale and facilitate quite a few of companies that expect to play in this market in South Africa as part of their $22 billion green energy, green industries investment plan. In fact, it's happening. Now, if we're going to have two different types of interventions for high-pressure and low-pressure systems, let's stop for a moment and think about how possibly the high-pressure systems can be supported financially, because, I mean, it's unlikely that government's going to have off the fiscus support the high-pressure intervention plan like it does for the low-pressure. And so there you need to be a bit more intelligent about it. I mean, it's a combination of money. If you think about a total system, my little arrows give you an indication of all the contributing areas where the money will come into the total cost. And, you know, there could be a contribution that comes from the tariff, which is obviously through NERSA. And then, and it's important if we involve the insurance industry, then there will be that replacement cost. In our discussions with SAIA, the Insurance Association, they were quite adamant to say that they've got to ensure that they continue to make money, and what they called it sustainability. And so, you know, that's still a debate to what's enough, you know. So they are willing to replace a geyser, but if you're not prepared to increase your monthly premium that you pay as the insured, then it will be only at the current replacement cost of a electrical geyser. So that's certainly not going to cover the total cost. Then, Andrew mentioned earlier about the whole carbon trading mechanism, the CDM mechanism. That presents an opportunity, but that's very retrospective. So there, in something like that, an IDC needs to come in to be able to, you know, a priori provide the funding for that, because that is recovered retrospectively based on CO2 emissions, and which obviously happens as the system is working on Euro. So you could top up the funding with that kind of financial instrument. And then it is highly plausible and probably desired that the homeowner makes a nominal contribution. So if we push the price down, let's say from a current 20,000 rand system, and it's shocking, I mean, you get systems out there for 35, 40,000, and I promise you they don't necessarily make the cup of tea. I mean, they just still warm the water. So if you work on pushing that price down from a 20,000 mark to around, say, 15,000, which is a 25% saving, then you could nominally expect the homeowner for a Rolls-Royce high-pressure system to contribute a few thousand quid, a few thousand rand, certainly up to 5,000 maybe for the total system. Then it becomes, the return on investment for the homeowner becomes very useful. Secondly, if the insurance industry or the banking industry in this case agrees, it appreciates the value of your house, which is what you want at the end of the day if you resell your home. So that is a discussion that is certainly hot and heavy, and we are having it with both the banking sector as well as with the insurance industry. But I'm giving you a sense of the kind of thinking we are involved in at the moment in that particular case. Regulatory change is certainly a very important player within this. We need to perhaps enforce even more the new building codes for compulsory renewables. The legislation is in place, so if you're building a new nice home, you need to have a certain percentage. I'm not sure if it's 17-18% perhaps, but you need to have a percentage of renewables. At the moment, you put in your LED lights, you put in a couple of things, water harvesting, and you try and address that. But certainly, new building homes, we need to stimulate the growth of the sector through that. You should be putting in a solar geyser. Possible amendments to policy on upgrade or retrofit. You and I have a home. We're making it from a single story to a double story. That legislation is not in place. I think we're a bit far behind there. It's a big concern. But that's not as easy as just use the same legislation. There's a whole lot of standards, national standards and ordinances that you impact on. So that is something that concurrently Public Works needs to work at within the steering committee. At component level, you know, we've had you know, on a daily basis, we have companies, South African companies, companies from Cape Town coming and really crying about the fact that, you know, they just cannot compete making copper tubes or Konex fittings or, I'm an engineer, by the way, so you can hear all the specifics. And it's a problem. So we need to address those loopholes from the imports versus the locally manufactured. And if we don't address that, we're going to find it difficult to just throw money at this problem. It will not go away. It will reoccur. So we need to address that. And certainly the designation in terms of the local content is a very powerful tool that we are going to use. And in fact, you will see it manifest itself in the kind of contracting that will happen. Guarantees is an important thing. It's one thing to put the keys. I think it was mentioned earlier. You know, when you go with the low-pressure systems and you look at the contracting model, using a retention approach does help, you know, withholding the funds, because that allows you then to, you know, not only grow the money that you retain, but also use it retrospectively. So using a contracting model with a retention approach methodology certainly assists within the guarantee framework. But quality assurance a priori is very important. So unlike before, every geyser that we install that is funded by state money, public funding, must not only be SABS marked, there's a distinction, it must be SABS approved. It's extremely important. And there is that distinction. And I'm sorry to say that is a loophole that we have now hopefully plugged. So that helps us with the quality assurance. I mentioned the retention as well, the retention amount, and allowing us to contract with either with the manufacturer on the one side and the installer. So we are the playmaker, and we contract with the installer, and the manufacturer allows us to have distinct contracts that work towards the nature of our relationship with either the manufacturer or the installer. This is, of course, in the contracting model. In the standard offer program, which is, of course, favored for the high-pressure systems, perhaps, and that you may be familiar with when you look at the large-scale renewable projects by the Department of Energy, you know, the large solar farms and wind farms, those use the standard offer program. The installer or the investor or the project developer, as they call it, retrospectively receives their remuneration for the installation, because it's based on CO2 emissions. And there the guarantee is almost inherent. It's a very attractive method, because if your system doesn't work, it does not reduce CO2, and so therefore you cannot claim it. So there's almost an inferred and in situ guarantee mechanism within the SOP model. But guarantees and installation and after-sale service is fantastic. But if I'm doing an installation, you know, 2,500 kilometers in Springbok, I'm inclined not to drive all the way out there to fix 10 geysers that don't work. So training the community personnel, persons, upskilling them, and this is not a mature technology, colleagues and respected colleagues, I mean, it can be done very successfully. A commitment is required, and perhaps some thought, that's where the carrot and the stick, is an important element with this. You need to train the community, train them to be able to maintain its general maintenance, wiping and cleaning, and where required, its replacement. This is not the kind of technology where you're going to redesign the vacuum tube. You're going to replace it, which is as simple as changing your light bulb. I'm being facetious, but I think I'm trying to push down that it's not rocket science. We don't need to build a university everywhere we install solar geysers. So we view community training and employment as an important part of the guarantee process. When one looks at the set aside for cooperatives, this is a challenging one, because, you know, you don't sort of throw money within an area and say there's a cooperative and it's sustainable, because many examples have not worked. So, but you know, within the contracting model, again, I think our approach is let's mobilize the capacity within the private sector to be able to assist us within this, rather than trying to build cooperative programs that exist that we will not be able to support after you've installed 100,000 geysers. So it will allow us to include those entrants that were excluded in the past, and certainly has the benefit of promoting economic empowerment. And opportunities for small component and sub-tier level suppliers. And a sub-tier level supplier could be the guy that supplies the copper fittings to the guy who puts it on the whole system on the roof. Kula, which is also one of our agencies, has been tasked to specifically help small enterprises. And the IDC, again, within their support programs for the big guys that's going to be funding, you know, the 100,000 or hopes to be involved in those, they have built in those specific agreements that the cooperatives need to be supported and those sustainability models must be demonstrated, which is, I think, a very important opportunity. So there's a way forward. We have engaged with the Insurance Association. You know, the pricing premium issue is certainly still an issue because we are trying to convince them that we cannot do it without them, and I think they recognize it. They're saying grow the size of the, on the demand side, grow the size of the sector, and we're saying, well, you know, the demand exists, there's a replacement market, but, you know, let's meet somewhere halfway. What is your requirement from us? And we have stated our requirements. So they are doing a study at the moment to determine the specific policy issues that they would need redressed by ourselves. Because there was this one concern that they had within the insurance association or the insurance sector from a legislative or legal framework that they cannot be seen to be biased towards a particular technology group. But of course, you know, the debate is it's not a tech, you can be biased towards a technology group like solar water heaters, but you can't be biased towards a particular manufacturing like Kamal brand. So I think that is something that they've gone back to the drawing board to ascertain where it's done. We are continuously trying to couple this industrial development funding that we have through the IDC and Kula in our particular case, certainly, with this contracting rollout model. The IDC and ESCOM is working very closely with one another, which is excellent. So the idea is that we can see some new players coming within the market. But as much as I would love to see new players in the market, I think we need to create that sustainability, which is volume. And again, I said this, 1 million does not make it, so we are thinking well beyond this. We're creating the foundations for the train to continue moving. We all know the announcement by the Minister of Finance of the expenditure framework allocation, and that's fantastic. And so that funding certainly will allow us to take it to add 800,000 or so to get to the 1 million giza, of which I think 80% will be the low pressure side and the others will be continuing on the high pressure. At the moment, we are finalizing the guidelines as the steering committee for the execution of the contracting model that ESCOM explained earlier. And that is specifically the kind of provincial mix that is required. It's specifically the criterion that will address some of the issues or concerns or the gaps that were raised by the Lakota plan that we have identified as well. So what would be the milestones? How will this be reported through? And, you know, how will the funds flow and how do we ensure, you know, localization has been taken in and has been measured, monitored, and evaluated? But I think we're comfortable, you know, with the low pressure. Certainly ESCOM has the critical mass. And the project steering committee with its core partners, I mean, Department of Energy, public enterprise is extremely important for us to be able to ensure that we are able to evaluate and tangibly come here and say that we've rolled out 80,000, we've created so many jobs, and it's more than before. And after the next PSC meeting, or even maybe before, if we resolve some of those within the core team, we expect that you will be able to see those projects being announced very soon. I think that's my last slide. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Parker. Honorable member. Honorable Fanningham.
Thank you, Chairperson. There are a number of abbreviations that I'm lost with. C-H-E-T, H-E-I, is it C-P-U-T? Yeah. And then is on your page 4, when you were talking about this program steering committee, you know, I'm so glad the portfolio chairperson of the Energy Committee has got this issue with these abbreviations. Because when he sees one, then he complains about it. And normally when we write to Parliament or any State Department chairperson, then we must write the full story out and then put the abbreviation in brackets so that we use it. I got lost now on the last page on PSC, and now I see it is actually on page 4. Human Settlement Department, I don't know if it's there. Then the replacement of geezers and the insurance companies. Do municipalities not have the policies already that for renovations and replacement and that they must do it now already? I thought, and in new builds, I thought it was policy, if I remember correctly, because also know that bulbs must be replaced. Then the import tax on solar geysers. What is the import tax on solar geysers? And what is the norm, because you've touched on it several times, what is the norm for the SA component? Because you have referred to it, but there's no percentage involved. And then the designation versus the import cost. Do you understand what I'm saying? You referred to on page, I didn't make a note of that page, that you were referring to the Department of Trade and Industry and the designation and special funding for certain projects. So I'm saying, how, if you designate a specific thing, can't you still import it at a cheaper price? You know, when in the agricultural sector, nobody cares very much when you can import cheap lamb or cheap beef or cheap chicken. Nobody is concerned about the South African production. So I'm now asking, where are we going with this one? Are we going to protect South African production and develop it and overtax the imported thing? Or are we going to, for the time being, to score against the shortage of electricity until the other power stations come into being, are we going to go, and I'm talking high pressure systems. LED bulbs, you know, you mentioned it vaguely, and I know it's not of relevance here, but I just want to say that last year I did ask the question about LED bulbs and whether they are in Parliament and whether they are in all government buildings and all state departments. And I don't think they are. So here we are preaching to the people out there saying they must put in LED bulbs and we don't. In local municipalities, certain areas have been skipped with solar water geysers simply because certain areas fell in the DMA areas of district municipal areas. They didn't form part of the local municipalities. And in 2011, with the election, they were incorporated into local municipalities. So, for instance, in Babiaans, you've got Willemoorn State Level, and they've now got solar geysers. But Riebron was a DMA area. And now they're crying because they're part of Babiaans, but they haven't got solar water geysers. So, is there a special program like with IMEP that you can sort out those pockets as well? Demarcation of beneficiaries, I find a bit difficult to understand, and then, of course, SELGA's role in it, because I think we need a little bit of explanation about that. Page 14, import loopholes and local content. It's the same that I asked at the top. The SABS approved and marked. What's the difference? Is it a fake one, or how do we know? Community training, installations, and you train one lot of people on installations. And they work in that community and they install all the geysers there. Once those geysers are installed, who knows better than them how to maintain them? So why do you want to create co-ops on top of that to then do the maintenance, because you've already trained one lot of people. They understand the components because they've put it together, they've installed it. So why create the co-op to follow on to that? Thank you.
I wasn't clear.
Sorry, I didn't. Is it Dr. Barker or Parker?
Parker.
Okay. Thank you. Chair, I just want to add on the issue about charity that begins at home, you know. what is the task team or Department of Economic Development doing in terms of greening government buildings? It's fine that we engage all these other institutions and so on, but we must start with us. I mean, we stay in the parks in Acacia Park and all these parliamentary villages. Nothing is actually happening. And we must really start where it matters. All these initiatives are very good and so on, but we must send out that message to say that as government, Department of Public Works, we're very sincere about it. Now, I like Dr. Parker because he moves out of the Golden Triangle. I always got this fight talked about the Golden Triangle in South Africa, here Johannesburg, Cape Town, and Durban. And when I hear Kakamas and I hear Rimfasmark and these other places there, I know, you know, we're singing out of the same hymn book. But the one element that I don't pick up in your presentation and other presentations is that where is this localization going to take place? It's fine to say now that, what's his name, installed, the geysers are installed and the co-ops must now assist with the maintenance and so on. But we will really address the issue of unemployment and poverty in your Kakamas and your Rimfasmark if government has got very strong strategic directives in terms of manufacturing in local areas. And unfortunately, we don't always get there. We just stay in the Golden Triangle of Johannesburg, Durban, and so on. Then the last remark, Chair, is the issue about this co-op. Now, you know, I don't know if I, this term, will understand government's approach on this thing, on co-ops, cooperatives. Purely because I don't think that, with due respect, that government understands that co-ops will only be successful if there's a sustainable financial chain. Now, once again, we want to create government, and we want to create this co-ops, but it's not financially sustainable. And that's the downfall. I think EDT has given us that statistic that only 10 or 13% of co-ops in South Africa are successful. I would rather go for a program to support small entrepreneurs. You know? Because at the end of the day, you are a successful entrepreneur if you can take ownership of a project. And co-ops, there's so many examples, fail because there's too many people involved in that value chain. And at the end of the day, it's not financially feasible for those people to be part of it. It's not financially worthwhile for somebody to get out of his house and go and work and do something. And that's the downfall of it. So co-ops for me is about the sustainability of the whole chain. So, yeah, that is my issue. Charity begins at home. Let's start with government.
Thank you. Honourable members, Dr. Parker.
Thank you. Let me start at the top. I apologize if some of the nomenclature or abbreviations were not sufficiently broken open or described before. No, it's fine. CPUT being, of course, an easy one, Cape Peninsula University of Technology, the former Pentec. HEI, Higher Educational Institutions. Higher Education, FET, I think, Department of Higher Education and Training, MT. So, if you wish, I will gladly I will gladly provide you with a narrative of those ones.
Just on a point of order, maybe the Honourable Prime Minister could one page just explain the acronym that he calls the DEA.
You can carry on.
Thank you very much. Human settlements is certainly within the project steering committee, and one of the things this is obviously a complex besides being a complex problem, but its solution is also quite challenging, you know, because often government don't know what other arms of government are doing. So we are roping in more departments as we find out, you know, that they are busy with things. I found out recently within the Western Cape that there's a 300,000 Giza rollout program planned here, which has nothing to do with the national government. So it's and even provincial government, Western Cape wasn't aware of it, but City of Cape Town is. So, yeah. So human settlements is involved. Their involvement would be certainly related to the low-cost housing projects, and identifying where it's suitable to install these low-pressure systems. With regards to the import duties, I think we must just be a little bit careful with regards to designation. It would be nice to be able to tax and duty everything that we don't want within South Africa to compete against our products, but that is not possible within the international norms and laws. And designation does not mean specifically that we are going to increase duties of imports of solar geyser products. It is one of the possible strategic mechanisms we could deploy, but the one that we definitely will want to use is the fact that if you and I are tendering for a project that Eskom has for 100,000 geysers to be installed in Ohrabis, see, I know that area by as well, you know, my geyser was made in Athlone, and yours was imported from somewhere. I don't want to mention the names, but then within the scoring regime, if I'm not mistaken, you would get 10 points and I would get 20 points, because the designation will classify or differentiate between that. And the level of scoring, the weighting, is where the specifics of the designation will come in. Maybe your frame comes from one place, you know, your tubes come from another place. It's quite a complex thing, you know. So you've got guys busy working out the whole day what the tube score must be, 2.22, and work it out. And that's what luckily Eskom is busy with. So that's what designation is going to do. It's going to allow you as South African companies a greater opportunity to be able to land that contract. Rather than going for the knee-jerk response, which is just duty the hell out of those guys that are coming from the country you mentioned, make it 50%, and if it's South African, then do that. Because then you're also being, you know, you've got to be careful. You're doing what the Japanese tried in the 60s and failed with that whole blanket import substitution, and it doesn't work. So you've got to be very measured with that. So that is what designation is going to do, ma'am. It's going to allow and give an opportunity to local content, local manufacturers, local suppliers, and within that even small, medium, micro enterprise and the entrepreneurs within that, which is another subsector, to have a greater opportunity to be able to secure work that is funded by the public money. That's what designation does. So it's not specific to the imports. You ask me what are the import duties on these components? You know, ITAC's not here. They're responsible for the allocations, but it varies on components. You can bring in a copper tube, which you use for an existing water reticulation, but you'll also use it in my solar water geyser, and the duty will be 12% up to 20%. So the classification codes will determine what your duty is going to be. If you bring in a complete solar water geyser unit, you know, your duties will be, because it's solar water heaters, it's renewable, it will be 10%, for example. But if you bring them in components, it could be 15 to 20%. And those are some of the loopholes that have existed that has allowed also products to come in at much cheaper. I mean, we've got to accept that. So That is another loophole that we are plugging. It's part of the designation address, which is to say that we need to look at those gaps, bringing in subcomponents, complete components. With the LED bulbs, I think we mentioned, I can't really comment on that, but it's part of demand size reduction, and the MTEF, the medium term expansion framework, has allocated a healthy allocation for companies and Parliament to go green. So you need to access that money. The areas that you mentioned, that's a very interesting point. You know, if there's a way that you know, the specifics that you've explained about the demarcated regions, if we can get that as an input, then we will certainly use that in identifying the regions. Because right now, we're going to use the FFC method to try and determine Limpopo is far behind. We need to at least allocate 200,000 there, Eastern Cape, X, Y, Z, etc. But within that, you see, you have these concerns that you've raised. So that is a very valuable input, and that's something I will raise at the next PSC, which is within the DMA regions, you know, those that were lost out, how do we address that? And I think there's a specific role that SALGO must play there as well. I think it's very important, because that kind of intelligence is very important to bring to that. You asked about the SABS, ma'am. You know, there are products that have a SABS mark, but they don't have the full SABS certification. If you certify a solar water geyser, there's a battery of tests that you need to comply with. It's not only the water side, it's the electrics, it's the valving, it's the mechanics, etc., etc. I don't know about fraud. I cannot comment on any of that. But what I can tell you is that what we're going to ensure that if a geyser receives an ESCOM contract, it should, ESCOM will ensure that particular mark is backed up with a compliance certificate and a scoring and a card and everything and its number, et cetera, et cetera. Because you can go into a hardware store today and find a geyser that has a SABS mark, but that has not been SABS approved. Whether it is because you can carry the mark while you are still in the review process, or whether you can carry the mark while you've made in your application. But in this particular case, you have gone through the battery of tests, and they've given you the piece of paper that says compliance number X111. You've gone through the whole screening process, and that's been. So that's what we mean by SABS approval, as opposed to an SABS mark. With regards to the cooperatives, you know, truthfully, it is something that we don't have a complete handle on. You yourselves have, you know, alluded to the fact that it's not an easy one. But certainly with regards to the training of the youth and the individuals and the communities, you know, within those regions, that's a given. That must happen. And you are correct. Who better to maintain the systems than them? And therein lies the sustainability, therein lies the opportunity to create entrepreneurs as well. And I think we're talking about this whole cooperatives idea within that framework. We're not talking about creating a superfluous or a redundant or a separate instrument. We're talking about using that. I mean, you've just created value by upskilling those people, and they know why that system will probably leak or not leak. So it's using that capacity within perhaps a cooperative framework where the community takes ownership. I told you, ma'am, I have an engineering background, and I'm sure many of you can relate to this. If you own the system, you take care of it much better than if you feel someone else is going to look after it and you don't own it. So ownership is intertwined with this whole guarantee, longevity, sustainability, empowerment, development, opportunity. So that's how we see the whole cooperative concept. Is the community owns it, they run it, they maintain it. Has the financial modeling been worked out? No, it hasn't been, you know. But this is the thinking behind that particular aspect of it. Greening of government buildings, Umpi is here, so certainly you can ask him. but I know the DSM has got a major element, demand side management or reduction has that within the medium-term expenditure framework, so I'm sure that's happening. Where will localization take place, manufacturing in local areas? We have had meetings with two provinces, We've had a meeting with local economic development within Gauteng already, as well as Northern Cape, to try and have exactly this discussion to say that, you know, if we're going to roll out 100,000 geysers in a particular region, how can we stimulate that area, you know, and make it sustainable as well? And it's not been an easy answer, because after the 100,000 geysers, the trucks have gone, what then? You know, and to make it financially viable, if you want to put it out in the middle of Mkondo or Donkerhoek, you know, there's no railway, your transport costs are 12 or 15%. You know, you can't stop the private sector from manufacturing where the input costs are minimized, but, you know, at least you know what you're getting for your funding, and you know that you are forcing them to employ, you know, or more people, create more sustainability within the guarantee and the maintenance regime that you're proposing within your system. And, you know, that's why I said when I started this whole discussion, the 1 million geysers that we are proposing to spend, the 4.7 billion rand, cannot be the end, because then, you know, we'll be asking for another 1 cent on the taxation pool in a few years' time. And so, therefore, the discussions of creating greater demand is a very important one to be able to address that. So, we don't have all the answers. The PSC has not resolved everything, but we've got to make it roll. The industry is hungry. It needs to start putting in geysers. It needs to start, the wheels need to start churning. To answer all the questions and have all the I's dotted, we think will hurt the industry.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Parker. We want to wish you also well in your endeavors, and we'll have more engagement. I'm calling Salga. So you're insulting all the other speakers?
No, I'm not.
You are?
No, I'm not.
You first apologize to the other speakers.
I sincerely apologize.
Now, give us your round of follow-up questions.
Dr. Parker, it's really been very exciting listening to this. Ownership in the low pressure market is an issue in an RDP house, because people do not repair their window panes. That is why in an earlier lecture or a presentation I asked what training and education is going to take place on how the system works, because I think it is really important that when the thing starts leaking, you walk in the street and you see that tap is running. It starts with a leak because the rubber has gone, but nobody fixes it or nobody does anything. So with a geyser, it's going to be the same thing. And this is why the ownership and the training for that is so important. When we were talking in my question earlier on about the replacement of geysers, the differential subsidy, used to be the more efficient the system, the better the subsidy. That's what I understood from my research on the internet. Yes. Now it looks as though it revolves around the South African component. And I'm not sure what the balance is. Then, when you speak to a contractor, I phone you, and I said, Dr. Barker, please, don't you want to come and install me? I've got a guest house. I need two lots of geysers. I've got six rooms plus my own. So I want two 250-liter geysers. He says, no, I don't install 250-liter geysers. I install 150-liter geysers. I'll give you three or four. Then I say to him, but why? He says, because the licensing fees for a 100-liter geyser and a 250-liter geyser are so far apart that it suits him. So is it really true that you apply for a geyser, a solar geyser with a specific capacity, and for a bigger capacity you have to apply for another type of installation license? We did not get to the Selga beneficiaries that they have to demarcate, was your wording? Then I see on page 12, and I'm very excited about this, electricity and your sources of funding, page 2, the second slide, page 12. You say there under the second bullet, electricity tariff. So you mean of the rate that we're paying, a certain percentage of that is going, the tariff that we're paying is going towards the solar geysers. And if so, what is the component? And if not, then I've lost you on that one. Please help me out. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and it's really been enjoyable.
Dr. Parker.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the questions. Okay, let's, if we can speak, if I can address the one about the, you asked about different geysers seem to have different certification requirements. Of course, that is under the purview of SAPS, right, South African Bureau of Standards. But certainly, if you have a 150-liter geyser and a 300-liter geyser or a 400-liter geyser, you would require, while the tests are similar, because you test the plumbing on the one and plumbing on the other, according to SAPS 1088 and 1088 on the other one, for example, you would require two different certifications for that. So the person you phoned was probably correct to say that, you know, if he sold you a 300 liter, he would require SAPS certification for that particular capacity unit, as well as certification for the 150 liter unit. My understanding, however, and that is true, SAPS charges you to certify on the different class, capacity class, you know, water literage. However, I do understand that, for example, if he certifies a 300-liter geyser, it may cost him, hypothetically, 35,000 rand. And then when he certifies, because there's a, let's say there are 10 tests that need to be done, you know, mechanical tests, mechanical tests, etc. It may be out of the 10 tests, 5 of them are common to both classes. But the other remaining 5 are very specific to that particular class of capacity, technologically. So that is the reason why they require two different prices or two different certifications. But I do know that SABS will tell you for the first one, they will charge you X, and for the second one, which is a different class of tank, they will not charge you X, maybe they'll charge you half X because some of the tests were generic. So that is the reason why the pricing will be different than what you would require. I mean, any greater detail on that, I think we have to speak to SABS to understand the specifics of it. But that certainly covers why they charge differently. In terms of are we migrating from looking at the Q factor or the thermal conductivity or efficiency of the geyser to purely local content? Not at all. It will be naive of us to do that. You don't want to put in geysers that were made fantastic out of my garage, 100% local content, but they all pop the next day. So the technology, the quality, well, that's where SAPS comes in, will be paramount. But we are introducing, or rather we're using a previous variable criterion called localization. We're just elevating it. We're giving it higher scoring, and we're making it much more important because that is a focus for us right now. We're not rescinding on the quality aspect. We're not saying we're prepared to settle for lower quality, not at all. And we're not saying to those that are not local, you can't come and play. We're saying you can come, but these are requirements. In fact, it stimulates large-scale companies to want to create local factories. In fact, that's what we are seeing. We're seeing the funny-named overseas companies now coming and saying, no, we are willing to set up a plant, you know, to manufacture and employ 500 people. It will have this throughput, et cetera. We don't even need funding. We will do it. But how do we make sure, you know, we are able to deliver, et cetera, et cetera? So that answers, I hope, your second question. Ongoing maintenance is exceptionally important. I think you mentioned about, you're concerned about the washer. You said ongoing maintenance, you know, and I think we agree with you fully. We are not suggesting market not stand. We are suggesting that the kind of maintenance that will happen, and that's why that 10% is so important. You know, on a 100 million rand contract, 10% is 10 million. I'm using the number 10%. Maybe it's 9.8, maybe it's 10.2. But that's a lot of money. And the idea is that that will be used to leverage and ensure that those systems remain work in working condition. It's certainly an improvement from the way it was done in the past, which was perhaps, not sure, a market not done, maybe. But now, the case is it's going to be much more difficult to just do that. And that will include having the system operational. And it's exactly why I said that those trainees that you have, those are the right people to be able to do the semi-skilled, minor, continuous maintenance, as they call it. Changing the washers, changing the ball valve, etc., etc. And maintenance doesn't mean you just equip the guy from a knowledge perspective. There's also he must have the tools, the toolbox, the spares that are consumables considered in an installation, you know. So it's the whole gambit of that. That's maintenance. I've got your solar geysers. I'm not sure if that answers all your questions or was there. Oh, okay. The particular slide that's on there, which is page 12, was to provide, as I mentioned, it's almost retrospective now. It's giving an indication of when we debated what are the possible sources of funding. Then it would be from the fiscus, which it is now. It would be from the tariff, which is what it was before, MYPD allocations to ESCOM. And if we're going to support industries or companies or entrepreneurs, then it could come from all of those other funding streams. So those were the possible sources of funding. And, of course, right now we're sitting with the MTF allocation, which is obviously from the fiscus. So thank you.
Honourable Lingan, any more follow-ups? You happy?
Happy.
Wonderful, wonderful. Thank you, Dr. Parker. And as I said, we will have more engagements with you further on, and all the best for you. Saga, are you ready? Members and guests, there is tea outside, and there's scones here on my left. Please move quietly, grab a cup of tea, and come back quietly. Drink it here. There is refreshments outside. Those that's in the room that's not having refreshments, we will bill it to your department or to you. Saga, will you just give us five? We just want to grab a cup. Cross it, thank you. It's a plus 50. Cream up you.
Thank you. So we'll be leaving before 6. We'll be leaving before 6.
Honourable members and guests, there's some people that has come from up north and from northwest and from Northern Cape and Eastern Cape. They don't know the traffic in Cape Town. The traffic is a nightmare. If you've got a flight at 6, I would suggest that we are not chasing you away, but for safety's sake, I think you should rather depart from the airport within the next 10 minutes or so on. Otherwise, you'll be stuck and the gates will be closed. And we don't want you to blame this committee for spending more time than you should have had. We would really love, as from the Western Cape, I would love you to invest in the Western Cape, spend another night at one of our beautiful hotels, have some more wine of the Western Cape, and leave the money here. But if you have to go, you have to go. Mr. Ettinger, thank you very much, and send my regards to Mr. Damas, and Salga.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much for the opportunity. I think this solar water heater program is an absolutely fantastic idea, and what we like about the thing is from local level side, local authority side, is the creation of jobs. But our concern would be, you know, that in creating this, there should be absolute local content as well. Another concern is the involvement of municipalities. On the one side, I've heard this morning a very positive attitude, especially from ESCOM, and the fact is that local authorities are the largest consumer of ESCOM's power. And we've never sat around the table yet. And it's time now, and I think that is what their attitude is now, it is time that we start sitting around the table. Unfortunately, if I look at the negative side again from, I'm sorry, Dr. Parker, economic development side, if I look at page 3, the Cabinet has approved engagement between key departments, and Salga has mentioned. But this is the following page, they have a program steering committee. Now, there Salga is totally out of the picture. If you look at the items that we'll discuss, localization plans, youth employment, these are all things that's on local level, it's municipalities. And that is what my concern is, that we as a sphere of government are not involved in this. And I think, Mr. Chair, you will agree with me
that it is time now that these different departments get us as SAGA involved, without a doubt. But our presentation is going to be very short. It's a repetition of quite a number of things that have been said this morning, but I will leave that over to Jan Mettler, and he will run it further. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair, members. The outline of the presentation will be some general comments. We would also refer to the ESCOM subsidy program, but only in brief, because that has been dealt with in greater detail. We will look at the rollout to RDP houses, models for such rollout, the issues around the replacement of geysers. There were also issues raised by Dr. Parker with regards to the role of the insurance industry. And then we look at barriers to implementation. And actually, that slide on barriers to implementation, that's also kind of the issues, you know, that one would need to debate. But some of the issues have been touched on by previous comments. In general, that geysers consume a fairly large percentage, up to 60% of total household electricity consumed in the mid to high income house. So it is obvious that a large scale rollout would significantly reduce electricity consumption. And in those households, water heating costs, because that is what the solar water system is all about, can be reduced by between 25% to even up to 40%. For low-income households, where warm water now becomes available, that would then also have a concomitant effect of improved health and of course savings benefits for such households. And I think that is a major social development indicator. In terms of the ESCOM subsidy, I think enough has been said around that, except that we would want to emphasize the last two bullet points, that many consumers can't finance the capital cost, which is still high. Also, the very practical issue of if it's not broken, don't fix it. You know, so why would I now go and change a perfectly healthy geyser and spend up to 25,000 rand? You know, so those are the practical considerations. If you're in the mid to high income, you know, it is not broken. And then, of course, the 2 months subsidy on both sides, both on the consumer side and on the supplier side, that is also a challenge. In terms of the rollout to RDP houses at municipality level, clearly, and it's been indicated also by the department as well as by Dr. Parker, that the low credit systems are much cheaper. There is no need for electricity backup in that case. Those households, as indicated before, are not currently using electric geysers, so the heating of the water is taking place through kettles or stoves, paraffin or electric. But studies would show that once there is a rollout to such articles, that electricity consumption does in fact decrease, but it's very slightly. It's very slightly because they don't have electricity, as I said, to start off with. But there is a reduction in consumption. We do find, however, that water consumption increases, because now instead of a small little container just to wash yourself, it's now possible to take a shower or even to bath. So there is that increase as well. From local government side, that should not be seen as an obstacle, because through proper billing and the metering of water, even in, with prepaid meters, which will give you 300 liters per day. You know, in the old days, there was an issue around prepaid meters where they could give you the 6,000 liters, and then somewhere in the middle of the month, there's a cutoff, and there's a court case around that. So the automated meters that are currently now being rolled out, also in the city of Cape Town, just by the way, have these 300 liters per day. Yes, it would increase the water consumption, but if those if it is correctly billed and people pay, then that is not an issue. That's not an issue. And in any event, these water meters now can pick up leakages even inside, not only outside, even inside. So the city, for example, or any city that uses automated meter reading systems, would then be able to, in RDP houses, be able to fix even if it's inside. So water consumption increase is not an issue. Then the models for the rollout, as far as the city is concerned, and we decided to take this one particular example because it's always good to come with a particular example to the portfolio, to the select committee. In terms of the middle to high income, where the city is now currently in a process, in a tender process, of where they would contract service providers who would subcontract suppliers or installers for the purchase of these geysers and the solar panels, only for that. In terms of the model, there would be no upfront cost to the household, because that is seen as a major impediment to the rollout. There is a fund established to provide the upfront financing and the bridging for the rebates, and the repayment would be via the city's billing system. There are very particular spin-offs for jobs, and the next slide would show that, for industry development, because you do create an economy of scale. If you have one institution that's buying across the metro. And I must also just add, as far as industry development is concerned, in terms of our finance management legislation, it is then possible for municipalities outside of the metro, other municipalities, to piggyback on this tendering system. So you don't have to go through that system yourself, as long as what is given to the city of Cape Town is given to you on exactly the same basis. So there is big potential here for industry development through the economy of scale. And that, of course, goes with competitive pricing, because we have, it is obvious that the prices in the industry are sky high because the demand is low. So if one can create this demand, it should have a concomitant effect on the pricing. In terms of this model, there would be a 10% reduction in electricity demand by the city. In other words, the city would buy less electricity from Eskom, up to 10% less. In terms of savings over 10 years, the calculations are that it's in the region of around 8 billion savings to households. In other words, households would over a period of 10 years pay 8 billion less in electricity charges to the city. However, there's also a 1 billion rand reduction in the annual electricity, in the annual electricity income to a place like the city of Cape Town and any other comparable metro. However, that should obviously be in isolation, and it's very, very important to make that point, because sometimes the argument is made that it's going to cost us, your typical electricity department who has certain targets, they would come to you and say, listen, energy efficiency is going to cost us, our budget is going to shrink, etc. But that's not the issue. The issue is also that you are buying less electricity from Eskom, and that is, so that is where the offset is. So the fact that there is a reduction, that should be neither here nor there. This is just a graphic illustration of how that intended a system would work. 300,000 rollout to mid to high income, and then the low income scheme is dependent on the Eskom funding. There's the only relationship between the service provider and the household is the provision of the solar geyser and the panel. There is no money flowing. So the first thing that I told him when they presented the model to us, I said, but aren't you privatizing something here? Because that's a big issue. I can go to Parliament to say that we are privatizing. They know all that we are doing is to create, is to contract the service provider that will buy the solar geysers at competitive rates. There's an arm's length relationship. All the money flow is between the city and the household. That is absolutely clear, and that is also in terms of the MFMA. In terms of jobs, if the mass rollout program reaches 50% of the city's houses, that's approximately 500,000 citizens, that would create what is called 10,200 job years over the next 10 years. Now, of course, you know, what's a job year? A job year, if there are 10,200 people, each of them would be able to work for 1 year. So if there are 1,020 people, they would work for 10 years over the 10-year period. Okay, so that is what this job years thing means. It took me some time just to get my head around the job years, because I'm not a mathematician, I'm just a lawyer, and these things are very difficult for us. The low income rollout is independent on the Eskom subsidy allocation, but it needs to be free to households, so they're just awaiting the revised subsidy amount. Now, Chairperson, in terms of the replacement of geysers, the issue was raised by the previous speaker, Dr. Parker, that it could be driven by the insurance industry. He has given an indication of what the numbers are. And we are saying that is a very good idea, but it needs to be regulated. It must be very clear on what basis and how that can be done. It cannot just be left to industry to win a water or when a geyser breaks, that it would be replaced by a solar geyser, because there's funding involved also from the public sector. So clearly there must be a legislative system in place in order to deal with that matter. So it can't be left unregulated. And of course, then when the geyser bursts, the consumer should then be given the option of the efficient water heating device. There's also currently a time lag due to the installers, due to slow rollout, but also the high cost. So there is a bit of a time lag there. And any additional costs could be taken up in the form of soft loans to the consumer, because in this particular category, mid to high income, there's a likelihood that there's a bond on the house. So if, for example, there is a system that says that the insurance industry should participate in this particular rollout, and there is the shortfall, they say there's a 12,000 rand, then that should be taken up. The industry should be able to give a soft loan to the consumer, possibly with a bond as security, but it shouldn't be. The additional cost should not be an impediment, because there should be a way, because there is a house and it is a mid to high income in a household. And Chair, I think this should be the last slide. In terms of the direct implementation, the high upfront cost has already been identified. It's a very high margin industry. As we've indicated, also the presenters before us, because of the low demand, you know, you're going to have to hit people very high in order for you to make a profit. So that's one barrier. So one must bring down the upfront cost. I think that's becoming obvious. There are also a limited number of trained technicians, both plumbers and installers, and that is market-driven. It's because there's a low demand. So obviously, there would need to be a particular intervention, but that has also been identified, Chairperson, by the previous speakers. There's also the issue of poor marketing to consumers. You know, you are really nervous of making the right choice. What machine, what thing do I use? Can I trust this person that's stick the sticker on. How do I know he doesn't have a roll of stickers in his briefcase, you know, and he's making the stuff at home? So people are naturally careful. And of course, your insurance company will get at you if you do make the wrong choice and there's a problem. There's also the hassle, I've indicated before, of replacing something that is working. So, again, you know, there's nothing wrong with my geyser. It's not likely that I'm going to install a solar water system and still have to pay for it. That is also a very practical barrier to implementation. Currently, there's a limited involvement by the banks and the insurance industry. So it's not easy to go and to get a loan if your cash flow, if you're not as prudent with your cash flow as most people are, that you certainly just don't have the 20,000, 25,000 for the upfront payment. So some of the intervention must also include involvement of bank and insurance industry in order to make loans available at attractive interest rates. Some municipalities, not all of them, but they are raising the issue of energy efficiency has an impact on municipal income. I've dealt with that argument in the previous slide, but it's also something that possibly from Salva's side we have to work on in order to make the point that it does not necessarily have to be the case. That yes, there may be more water use. Yes, you know, you may not get what we have put into the budget as income from electricity, but there would be the saving and so on. So there's also that kind of a barrier at technical level. And if you understand how a municipality works, the reports are generated at a technical level, and it's the attitude of the person that drafts the proposal that really influences the way that decisions are made. That's an absolute reality. So it is winning the hearts and the minds also of those that have tried these kind of reports, so that there is a balanced approach to the rollout of these cases. Chair, thank you very much. I think that's the last one. Oh, yes, sorry. Last one, just in terms of the regulation, it's up to 50% of hot water to be sourced via the energy-efficient sources in all new buildings. In terms of the they call it the XA building standard. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Metler. Councillor, anything you want to add? Or say? Or?
Not at this stage.
Not at this stage, okay. Members, it's over to you. Honourable Sinclair.
I want to engage the issue about what Dr. Parker referred to some extent is the carrot and stick approach. Now, also in this presentation, we see that there's a lot of motivation to say that the banks and so must get involved. But the reality is that as soon as there's risk involved, the banks don't have the appetite to involve them in these type of things. So, I really believe that from a governance perspective, it's necessary that we must, through regulations or legislation, regulate this whole drive better. To put, for instance, the insurance industries and the banks through their housing possibilities in a bit of a fix, if you like, to also assist government to achieve this mandate. Because at the end of the day, it's got the underlying argument is that we need to save energy and look at the demand side. But, you know, I've got, all of us, I suppose, got frustration with this thing with the banks and so on. They never come to the party. I know my old story about the government, but I'm not going to use it on the government today. But the banks, they speak like Tarzan, but they walk like Jane, you know, when it comes to these type of things. And so, now they say one thing and they do another thing, you know, but it's usually directed to the ANC, but today it's directed to the banks, you know. So what we need to do is we must create a legislative framework that if a geyser must be replaced, then it must be a solar geyser. You know? And I like specifically the last part, but my question then to Salga is, can we amend that legislation to make it possible to achieve exactly that?
Thank you, Chairperson. I've heard Salga mentioning the fact that we can import solar high pressure systems for 7,000 rand from Australia. So I'm asking if that will be subsidized or can be subsidized or not. Then where would the City of Cape Town find that bulk funding to create the fund to encourage this this transfer in your middle and upper income groups? The next question would be the payment via city's billing system. Over how long a period would that be? Is it, you know, how many, and how much, obviously then it'll mean a certain percentage will be interest over the first X number of years, and then it'll be. And then the last point that you've got in that slide, 1 billion reduction in annual electricity income to the city. But you're talking about an 8-year period. So I think that the city will grow so much in the 10 years to come that it will not have necessarily the reduction in annual income of electricity. Eskom heats the prices up. I mean, we're just going to pay and smile.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. Yes, very interesting. We've been hearing the whole morning about the geysers, and we should actually also be subsidized for people that want to go green. I want to ask a question. You mentioned about the water leakages. Who would be responsible? Because normally, if there's any leakages within your property, you are responsible. And it's interesting to see that, you know, I think I should move into an RDP house so that the government can just take place of everything and pay my rent and pay my house, my bond, my everything. Yes, and become a co-op. Thank you.
Oh, my name? Oh, okay. All right. Over to Councillor Mr. Mettler.
Mr. Chair, you know, the other day I came to my bank and I realized my bank is bankrupt. Because, you know, when I stuck my card in and it came out, and they said no funds available. So, yes, I think that is true that our banks should have more leniency as far as looking after, especially homeowners. I think they should have some more leniency about their situation. Whether we can amend the legislation, not from Salga's side, yes, we can try and work through it, but I think you all know what lengthy period it takes and what is all involved, you know, to have any legislation amended. Yes, if we can try and push it from our side, yes, we will try and do that. But I think we'll have to get the support from our superiors as well and our members as well, exactly how, where, and what. And I think we can, for instance, try and put this over as a matter of a discussion for Salga's side. The import from Australia, that was just mentioned by somebody when we spoke about the prices, and they said, but now you can get a system at 7,000 from Australia. It's actually manufactured in a different country, but it's under the Australian name. But now afterwards we realize there's a different system into Africa that's even cheaper. So we disregard the factor, you know, of the Australian situation. As far as Cape Town situation is concerned, we, as such, we haven't got the finer detail. But I think, according to the questions, this is something that really I myself also would like to follow up on how they achieve a lot of things. Especially together by the MFMA and what was the other one? There's the period of redemption and so forth. That is not clear to me myself, and I think between myself and Johan, we will try and finalize it and get that information as well So if there's an opportunity in the future, we will be able to assist there. I think I'll have to agree with you that 8 billion does sound a bit strange, or 1 billion, and due to pricing, because I think if you mention they said it at today's terms, today's terms. So yes, in future I think there's going to be quite a change, because money's worth is going down all the time.
Perhaps it is safer to come back in writing to the committee on exactly how that, on how the cap-on system works. You know, instead of relying on second-hand information, because I do think it's an important initiative, and one must be very clear, how it works. With regard to the water leakages, it is so that in the normal course of events, in the normal case, that a municipality will only fix a leak outside of your boundary, because that is public property, and not inside. Inside is your problem. However, in the case of RDP housing, it becomes problematic if you sit in a situation where often people, the residents, they cannot afford sometimes the basic services. So it's a very real problem. It's not something that you can turn your back on, because in the end, local government will pay. If the water leaks there and people cannot pay, you can't cut off the water, because that's unconstitutional. So it is in fact in the interest of the system as a whole. The city has, in this particular case, adopted the attitude that in terms of the RDP houses, that it is more cost effective to go and fix. It's more cost effective than to sit with a huge bowl of water that has lost in the system, which city must pay for in any case. So it's a very practical approach to a problem that's very real.
Honourable Farrington.
Mr. Chair, Bobbejaan's municipality has a health desk. And I'm mentioning the municipality because they are so concerned about leakages and problems such as that they actually, when somebody comes and says there's a leak, they as municipality, they go and fix it. And then the other thing that I find very interesting is that when I don't pay my rates and taxes, there have been a couple of court cases where they will cut off my water and electricity, and it's now been approved. The judgment was against the consumer. The third thing, can municipalities then, when a person is not paying his water or his electricity, they only were prepaid as only electricity. Water too. Okay. But if they owe the municipality money, can a certain amount of that prepaid electricity or water, like 60%, can that go for the outstanding account? So if I buy 100 rand worth of, say, electricity, can 60 rand of that go towards the redemption of my electricity?
DA controlled City of Cape Town does it. I don't know what who's controlling Bobbejaan's. Bobbejaan's? Is it? Oh, but the DA controlled City of Cape Town, or the municipality of the City of Cape Town, if that will make it easier for you, Honourable Van Lingen, they does it. If you've got an electricity bill, they take it as utility service. If you are in arrears with your bill, they take, I think it's 10 or 20% from the amount that you buy from that utility, from that money. Say, for argument's sake, if you buy 100 rand worth of electricity, they give you 80 rand worth of electricity, and 20% of that comes off towards your arrears. Over to you, Mr. Metler, and Councillor. Now you've got the floor.
Okay, I can add to that, because that's quite correct. But what the courts are very clear on is that that must be part of your credit control and debt collection policy. It must be part of the policy. So it can't be something that you decide on just one day. You can't wake up and say that from now on you will it will be handled in that way. So there's a systems act that prescribes a particular procedure or a whole public consultation process in terms of which a policy like that has to go through the council system for approval. A council can also decide not to do that.
They've also put it part of the indigency plan, because if you don't, for argument's sake, they've sent out flyers that, and also with the bills, that if you don't approach them for indigency plans, they will then take any other steps necessary to recoup the outstanding debts. Honourable Abrams?
Thank you, sir. I just want to comment and say it makes economical sense to repair if there's a leak, if somebody reports it. In Johannesburg, Gauteng, we've got so many water leakages, and it's underneath, and nobody knows about it, but you see it and they won't repair. So maybe we should just take it from the city of Cape Town and take it to the rest of the country. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, may I ask, where is Gauteng?
Because city of Cape Town doesn't repair leaks inside your house. Only the RGP houses, yeah. So I think we should take the... Are you moving to City of Cape Town from Gauteng? Because... no, thank you, gentlemen. Sorry that you had to wait the whole day, but I think it was very worthwhile, your presentation as well. And we also want to wish you well in your endeavors ahead. And we hope to see more of each other. Really, I think that the Honourable Van Lingen has loved Salga, has fallen in love with Salga. We would like to see you more at our committee.
Jim, I'll just add, I think the biggest concern that we have is that our, the cooperation with the other departments, that is still lacking, because these people keep us out of the dark as far as it's concerned, and we really can't give our members input, you know, to this organization, and then we're losing out, you know, and the country's losing out by it.
Very much for that. Now, honourable members, it seems to me we've come to the end of our energy. Sorry, thanks, Grace. Ompi, you are sitting so quiet the back there. I thought we are finished. Grace has just pulled me now to say no, energy must still present. You thought you were off the hook? Thank you very much, Honourable Sinclair, that you have placed and put the committee on such a regard. We really thank you for that.
From the opposition side, we just want to put a motion of full confidence in your meeting.
Motion of full confidence.
Yes.
That's accepted. You think? Can we accept that, you think?
I'm not sure what the motive behind it. In the next committee meeting with the flag on
that. Oh, thank you, Youth League. You see, there's no nationalization on the cards today, so the Youth League is supporting. Ombe.
Thank you, Chair. Honourable members, I apologize. It's the graveyard session. I'll try and keep it as, you know, painless as possible. So what we have done is we've taken a different front. It's by way of a progress report reflecting on some of the challenges that have been encountered towards the political target of 1 million solar water heaters by 2014-15 financial year, as announced by a minister in the 2009 budget speech. And so as we said today, it's funded both from the fiscus and from the tariff. Initially, because it was funded mainly from the tariff, the uptake has been very slow. And the program is promulgated under the Division of Revenue Act. In other words, it involves municipalities and ESCOM as both Schedule 6 and Schedule 7. And we enter into funding agreements with both entities, and it's conditional grants that are given to them. The progress so far, Chair, was that we started the financial year with a baseline of about 55,000 systems with a target of 250,000 in order to be online, on target for the 1 million by 2014. And out of the fiscus, we'd like to reflect on some of the challenges that have been experienced with some of these municipal programs, because we believe that it will give a sense about some of the issues that need to be resolved going forward. Back then in 2010-11, three allocations where the pilots were given to Naledi, Solplaki and Tswane municipalities. Solplaki and Tswane have both completed their systems, but there are specific problems at Naledi that I'd like to go into a little bit more detail than what ESCOM has done, because we believe that perhaps even for the sake of SAUGA, we'll be able to find a common ground to resolve it. The issue, Chair, is, relates to the fact that we make certain assumptions around the installation of solar water heaters that do not necessarily link with the water challenges that we experience as a country. So you start as a solar water heating program, and then suddenly you find yourself, you know, on the other side of the fence. You're now dealing with water issues. Firstly, those that are not connected to water. When we say we want to provide low-cost housing with water, the assumption is that there will be water reticulation right into the house. There are also issues around the quality of the water itself, so even where there might be water and the specific issues, I think we had earlier this morning about hard water and so on, but we just want to just touch on that. And then the issue of bad roofs and the kind of piping that you know, gets encountered in the program. And ultimately, these are the issues that without their resolution, you might not be able to proceed with the solar water heater program in the manner that this is planned. So Naledi Municipality, for example, suddenly the systems have been allocated funding and you discover that there's a hard water problem that has to be dealt with. And you have to remove the, you know, the calcium and other solubles, just one of the solutions, or chemically treat the water through reverse osmosis. And that, in relation to the number of systems that were earmarked for this municipality, introduces a cost of about 9 million rand, the capital cost of 9 million rand, but over and above that, every 6 months, another 1.2 million rand, sorry, the type is not 12 million, it's 1.2 million rand. So you're looking at a sustainable solar water heating program, provided that you spend 9 million upfront treating the water and another 1.2 million rand every 6 months, or let's say 2 million rand every year, just to make sure that the water does not damage the solar water user tanks and so on, the piping and so on. Now, that was not just the only situation where we find this particular problem, because in the rural municipalities, by and large, you find that this is prevalent, where you have to intervene on the water side before you can include a program to install solar water heating. And we give an example here of, you know, five rural municipalities, which require about another 100 million rand, more or less, just in terms of making sure that you have a sustainable solar water heating program. These hidden costs, we don't normally provide for. We always provide for the capital cost of the unit without necessarily dealing with them. And based on this, you know, example with Naledi in particular, suddenly you find that you have to move projects around. So you start in a particular area and another division of revenue at processes. It's difficult to move money from one municipality to the other, particularly once it has been gazetted and so on. In this instance, the project has been relocated to Maluti, approving because of the preparation work that has been done in terms of that. And when implementing agents like Eskom flag this particular problem, it says that, look, we do have additional funding, 4.7 billion rands have been allocated in the next three financial years, but it is not as simple as there is the money and therefore we'll be able to go ahead and install those solar water heaters without any particular problem. Perhaps also, Chair, a similar kind of problem that we encounter on the municipal side that relates to the division of revenue framework as a channel for these funds is that you have to find a way in terms of which municipalities do some preparation themselves. You know, and those preparation we generally refer to as business plans, but they could be feasibility studies to ensure that, you know, they have had some, you know, a sense of those problems that reflect, for example, the water quality, the extent to which there's reticulation inside the houses, the circumstances relating to the roofs, and so on. Chair, we've heard all day about, or all morning about, the fact that there is an issue with the rebate program. If I take you back to last year, late, maybe the third quarter of last year, one of the biggest challenges we're facing was the fact that the rebate program or the rebates themselves were not enough to roll out the 1 million solar water heating. And a revision of the rebates was necessary in terms of the actual subsidy that was provided. And I think Honorable Van Lingen raised the point about linking to the Q factor, that had been problematic and needed to be revised, first thing. And secondly was that there needed to be additional subsidies because only 260,000 subsidies had been made available in terms of the rebates that Eskom was allocating. And we're just flagging on the slide the changes to the rebates that had been promulgated at that time or in the period up to June last year. And this is in respect of both the low pressure and the high pressure systems. And as you can see, particularly for the high pressure, and I apologize, I don't have a pointer, but around, you know, these kind of levels here of around, you know, 3,000 to 8,000 maximum rebate. For a system that costs 15,000, the electricity consumer normally votes in a particular way, and they vote by just saying away. And you'll see in the next slides the extent of the penetration on the high pressure side of things. So we see this as being a bit of a problem. The fact that the installations happen mainly on the low pressure side, and I'll go into some detail around that. This slide just indicates the, and I'm sure you've seen this before, I think the last time we came here, there had not been any installation in some of the provinces, and now there is some uptake in all the provinces, even though I think Limpopo, Mpumalanga, and perhaps in Northwest are lagging substantially behind. Initially, the Eastern Cape was leading, mainly because of the Nelson Mandela pilot project, but by and large, this has now spread to other provinces as well. Nonetheless, we see this as being a particular problem, that there is not an equitable distribution of the solar water heating installations. But perhaps this slide illustrates the biggest problem from our perspective, and I think Honorable Sinclair raised this earlier on today, is that if you look at the distribution between the number of solar water heaters that are high pressure and the low pressure, you'll see that four times the amount is installed on the low pressure side, and yet the savings that result from that are not even equal. So it's almost like you have to install 5 low pressure units in order to achieve the savings of 1 high pressure unit. And therein lies the problem, particularly because we're saying that if one looks at the funding of this program as a social program, right, then there is no problem. However, keeping in mind that the 1 million target is just a political target, you know, there are perhaps 12 million houses in this country, right, it's going to get to a point where even more fiscal resources have to be drawn into the program in order to be able to do that. So, for example, if we say 4.7 billion rands will give us 1 million systems, then for 10 million systems will require 47 billion rands. And so the argument goes, and we're talking purely low pressure without necessarily achieving the savings that we desire. So it is not necessarily a very sharp energy efficiency and demand side management instrument. And that's why we believe, Chair, that we would then need another complementary model, and I think my colleague Kamal did allude to it. We call this a standard offer model, which we want to go into a little bit of detail around that. We're saying that this model we want to pilot with some 250,000 systems within this financial year. And maybe just to go into some detail about it, is that first of all, the standard offer process is a virtual power station that we're building. The concept is the same as what we use for renewable energy projects, you know, wind, solar, and so on the supply side. What this does is it's exactly the same thing, but on the demand side. So instead of putting megawatts or megawatt hours into the system, you're taking off megawatt hours through the solar water heating. Now, it's all about risk allocation, and I think, well, there's been a lot of comments about how banks will participate and so on. It's about stretching the rand, or the limited finance that we have within the system, that we believe, or we do not believe, that you pay for a power station cash. Nobody buys their house cash, right? So you don't go into the bank, and the house costs 100,000 rand, and you pay cash for the 100,000 rand. You pay over a period of time, right? So it's a loan that gets taken up and it gets amortized over a period of time. And we believe that is exactly how power stations ought to be built, right, in a manner that aligns the risks, so that if there are any problems relating to guarantees or maintenance or all of these other life cycle and management issues, you are able to get the necessary recourse. So with this standard offer thing, every solar water heater will have a certain amount of deemed savings. So you're not going to measure the savings on each roof, but you will deem the savings, and this is compatible with the UNFCCC, the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, for the certification of emission reduction certificate. So basically what we're saying is that you pay for the solar water heater over a period of time. You don't pay cash for it, because if you ask people to pay cash and the cash is 15,000 or 20,000, we have seen what the outcome is. The outcome is that nobody takes the thing up. Not even Sandton or Cape Town, you know, takes the high pressure systems up. Over the last 2.5-3 years, we've only had about 42,000 systems. So conceptually, this is how it works. We say that there is a certain amount of funding that is required, and that funding is basically the capital cost to install the systems, but there's also the interest portion of it, right? And this funding, and there was a question around that, will be obtained from some debt, right? So there's only one source of thing. The source of the funding is commercial debt, but there could also be soft debt as well. And the question becomes, if there is a loan to finance the solar water heating, then the issue is, how do you service the loan? So if you don't have any, you know, closing of that loop, so to speak, then nobody's going to give any loans into this process. And we heard earlier on about how commercial banks are not going to come to the party. But it's exactly the same situation with solar, with renewable energies, be it wind, etc., that the banks give loans because they are comfortable that their loans are going to be paid over a period of time through what we call a power purchase agreement of X term. So, in this particular case, if we start from the bottom, is that we're saying that there could be grants that go into the repayment of this loan. Right? This is the soft money. But we also understand that the grants that are available are minimal. So it's not like we're going to get grants to the tune of 50 billion rands as such. Let's go to the next one, and I want to skip the MIPD for now and go to carbon credits, right? That we believe that because this is compatible with the clean development mechanism, that certain funding could, you know, flow from the trading of the carbon credits emanating from there. I think we've spent a lot of time today dealing with the fiscal program, and I've also indicated that there's 4.7 billion rand that was the Minister of Finance announced last week, and I can we'll come back to that as well in a little bit of detail. But essentially what we're saying is that this is about a power station, so the tariff allowance, right, that builds power stations needs to make provision for perhaps the cheapest power station that could be built. Right? So as opposed to the MIPD, the multi-year price determination is the tariff increase that ESCOM, as the aggregator, applies for every 3 years. Right? So when that happens and we say tariffs must increase by so much, a certain allocation must be set aside for building this cheap power station that is driven by solar water heating. And as such, because it's an opportunity cost argument here, where the marginal cost of supply, in other words, the cost relating to building a MEDUP power station, is a lot more than the cost of building this power station, you are not dependent on the end user to service that particular loan. So you're able to go into Cape Town, into Sandton, into all these urban areas, into the high LSM market, and ask for the beneficiary to make a nominal contribution towards the solar water heater. So, for example, you could ask the beneficiary to pay 100 rand a month for a term of 5 to 7 years. You know, so it's something that we believe would be very attractive to those that can afford to pay that amount of money. And the bulk of it would then come from the actual tariff. Okay, I want to just touch on why we believe that this is very critical, because from a Department of Energy perspective, there are certain objectives that we have defined, you know, as being very critical for a successful program like this one, right? And it's largely premised on, shall we say, 4 or 5 key pillars of a program like this. Is that first of all, we're saying that this program must reduce electricity demand. Right? So it must be very sharp in the way that it reduces electricity demand. So where you install solar water heaters only in low-income segments, you are not necessarily making the impact in relation to this specific objective. The next objective is one of universal access. Yes, there you would have universal access if you use a low-pressure system only. Then there's also the issue about offsetting the rising electricity tariff, because again, if we do not build a cheaper power station, what it means is that we have to pay higher tariffs. So by not building this particular power station, we are not offsetting the increasing cost of electricity. And it's mainly because, as already indicated before, up to 60% of the water heating cost in the high segment, up to 60% of the tariff or the cost that you are charged by a municipality relates to water heating, by and large. You know, we say up to 60%, it could be anything from 30 to 60%. So you want to be able to take that whole load off and not use coal and MEDUP power station, but to rather use a solar water heating power station. Right. Then the next issue is about the accelerated service delivery. And in fact, we can go to town about this one. Basically, what it means is that there is another problem that we are trying to mitigate here, and it's the fact that as tariffs rise, there has been concern that we are not necessarily taking the poor with us. So we believe that this particular initiative cushions the poor from increasing electricity tariffs, because you're not only giving them free basic electricity, but you're taking 60% of their water heating costs off their budget, and somebody else takes care of it. And then there's also the issue around the climate change issues. In other words, the fact that we are able to reduce reduce the tonnage that would otherwise have been accrued from burning additional coal. Chair, the Renewable Energy White Paper makes an aspiration, or indicates an aspiration, of 10,000 gigawatt hours of renewable energy by 2030, and we believe that that could be met from both supply and demand side option, and this is a very good example of how this could be done. So what we have done here is, sorry, I apologize, I don't know if you can read that, it's very small, but I'll just give you the numbers, that in the upper segment, if we install 550,000 solar water heaters, just as an example, we're able to reduce the demand by 347 megawatts and introduce 672 gigawatt hours into the grid. And by the same logic, if we get to about, 5 million of these solar water heaters, primarily in the medium to upper segments of the market, we would be able to reach the 6,000 gigawatt hours in a very relatively cheap way. And you know, one can run different numbers in order to check what the outcomes of each would be. And Chair, this particular slide also indicates what we believe is, for us, you know, if you like, the Bible around the solar water heating, is that we're saying these are the objectives, right? And these objectives have to be met, and these objectives have a cost, and they have a certain benefit. The benefits have been quantified here, and on the next slide, we indicate the cost. For example, we believe that cumulatively, and if you look at just the numbers, and I apologize again, you can't read this, but I'll just tell you what the numbers are. In terms of the amount of money that is required, it's about 194 million every year, etc. It will get to, let's just see, 1, 2, 3, 4, for about 5 billion rand, right, of capital allocation, with a portfolio, as indicated there, of upper income, medium income, some insurance replacements, and those that do not necessarily have electricity. We can programmatically introduce the solar water heating program in order to do this. Sorry, I was reading the wrong. Yeah, sorry, that's the number, yeah. It's about 5 billion rand that we believe that one could introduce around there. And therein, you know, Chair, is a set of permutations that one can follow. And my colleague from Economic Development did allude to that, is that what we are saying is that, having regard to all of this, the problem is not one of chasing numbers anymore, right? So we know that there's enough money in the fiscals for us to install 1 million solar water heaters. The problem suddenly changes to that of, you know, how do we localize, how do we integrate into the value chain, and make sure that the jobs, you know, are not exported to all these other areas. Very quickly, to indicate that late last year, we signed as the stakeholders under NEDLAC with government, civil society, business and labor, various accords, the Green Economy Accord, the in terms of which certain commitments were made by different people, and so I'm not going to go into the detail, but it's self-explanatory there. But we also had another accord that relates to local procurement, right, wherein, for example, those that want to manufacture have indicated what their barriers are, so that we can, address those barriers, including those barriers relating to skills development and education. And under this accord, we believe that we would be able to engage with the stakeholders in order for us to be able to address those constraints that we face. And this is the detail of it, so I'm going to skip these slides. Chair, that it's got to do with the solar water heating itself, the components, and also the replacement market, which is mainly the insurance thing. And then the issue around guarantees. I think particularly in the context of a low segment fiscal funded program, this is the biggest problem. We've got some 250,000 systems installed, and one of the biggest risks that we face is what happens when these units start failing and they are on people's roofs and they are ownerless. Incidentally, we do not derive any comfort from a capital rebate program for this particular reason, that when you transfer the money and the installer has walked away and even liquidated for that matter, there's absolutely no recourse when the systems start failing. I think promotion of the systems we have touched on earlier today, also the technical standards. I have also alluded to the 4.7 billion rand, say what we are intending to do for the current financial year, sorry, the looming financial year 12-18, is to find a delivery model, as already indicated through the project steering committee, that would then be able to make sure that the funding that is available here, is alive to those objectives that we have set for ourselves, so that the models that we use are responsive. Chair, maybe very quickly on this one, is to indicate that the Division of Revenue Act, under which the solar water heating program is now appropriated, is promulgated every year. And I'm not so sure that the Division of Revenue Act 2012-13 will accommodate some of the nuances that need to be included because of this program. And let me give an example, is that by and large the money goes to ESCOM and to municipalities. But let's take municipalities as an example. Chances are, for the reasons that Salga so nicely put, advanced, is that chances are the solar water heating system or the rebates are going to go into the low segment market only. Right? And there's a reason for it. And the one reason is the fact that, and we heard earlier on when the question was posed to ESCOM, is that, yes, the high pressure program will continue, but that model, which is based on you having to, make a top-up contribution of 12,000, 9,000, whatever that number is, will not necessarily facilitate a quick uptake, we believe. That's the one reason. But the second reason is that for reasons relating to the adverse impact of energy efficiency on municipal revenues, that municipalities would be inclined to go towards those areas that will not make that impact, that adverse impact. But I think thirdly is that, remember, once the money has been allocated to a municipality under the contractual framework that is available under the DORA, it is the municipality's prerogative as to the targeting. Right? So it's not like, it would be easy to say to the municipality that this is how your portfolio of beneficiaries must look like between high segment and low segment. So we believe that there might have been a cause to look at the Division of Revenue Act more carefully for this particular reason. I think maybe that's enough about that. But Chair, just to conclude, is that we believe that the solar water heating program has some challenges, particularly as we have experienced on the low pressure segment, relating to water quality issues and so on. We also believe that the responsiveness of the high segment market is premised largely on, shall we say, a lack of appetite to make additional capital contributions given the high cost of these systems. Incidentally, I think what we also needed to indicate is that when we talk about the low pressure unit, it is dominated by a technology, the evacuated tube technology, and the evacuated tube technology is 100% imported into this country, right? And one has to ask the question as to whether, the import substitution that we're looking at in this space would necessarily create the economies of scale to allow you to compete with the likes of China, where this technology is largely imported from. So there are those questions that one still needs to address. As for the targets, I have already indicated that this is easily in sight because there's additional money now, And I think now we need to change, you know, it's not so much, have you installed the 1 million, would you install the 1 million? I think the paradigm changes now to asking questions around alignment of the program with those objectives that would have been set for ourselves. We're saying that it's a million solar water heaters by 2014-15, but evidently this is not the point. The point is that it's a power station, a virtual power station, that is cheaper than supply side options, so we need to increase this to all the houses in this country and that use hot water, that they need to do that. We've touched on the issue of the green economy around the localization, but this is the competency of the Department of Economic Development and DTI and so on, so we're working very closely with them in order to make sure that you know, we achieve our set objectives. And then lastly, Chair, is that we still believe that we must not lose sight of the energy efficiency objective, you know, that perhaps under the circumstances of supply-demand imbalances and, you know, problems on the electricity side, that the standard offer concept needs to be advanced in order to start improving the uptake on the high segment. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, TTG. Honorable members. Okay, it was really the graveyard shift. Oh, Honorable Flamingan.
Thank you, Chairperson. Does that mean the Naledi project has been stopped altogether? Or will it be resumed at a later stage?
Mm-hmm.
Then, on page 5, and it would probably be your slide 10, no, your slide 9, you talk about feasibility study is necessarily undertaken in each municipality to clear remedial actions prior to the start of the rollout. Now, I happen to live in a municipality where no RDP houses can be built because there's not sufficient bulk services. There's not enough water, there's not... And for that very reason, feasibility studies can say, yeah, but you can bring it in and you can mitigate. And I hate the word mitigate, but they use the word mitigate. And they, environmental affairs now only accept engineering studies of the possibilities of what can happen. Then, with this funding, I'm a little bit confused. Is the funding for both systems going to the municipalities? And then the municipality decides where it's going. So I don't understand what then happened to the contractors. My great concern is the debt situation in local municipalities and the inability to ring-fence funding. And I think that for the time being is all. Thank you for a very, very interesting subject in my presentation, and maybe please have it in electronic form as well so that we can read the figures tonight or tomorrow morning. Thank you very much.
Honourable Abrams.
Thank you, sir. I just want to say thank you very much for an interesting presentation to all the other presenters too. It was very enlightening and very well synchronized. Thank you.
Okay, Claire.
Okay, I just want to speak on the broader context of this. It's good and well, and I mean, we all support this whole drive. But the reality is that municipalities are going to lose a source of income, a serious source of income. Now, in the broader context, what is the view of the department in terms of addressing that? Because it's fine to save a billion for the consumers. But that revenue must somewhere be generated, somewhere else. Naturally, the local authorities will then come and knock at national government's door to say, but increase in terms of the FSC as the allocation.
This is a difficult
question. Okay, Honorable Marine.
Thank you very much. You know, I don't want to speak to the effort you gave me to summarize, but because I wanted to talk to the COPS issue. start to give a little bit of an induction to co-ops, because on a trip to India, you're told that SMEs and co-ops are out there benefit the economy. But that will be an argument for another day. I'm a bit worried about though Honorable Valding has asked a question about that relates to the Naledi municipality, because that's I'm staying next to the municipality. It's in my province. Maybe that's how I'm speaking, because my province is then directly affected. My question would just be, this challenges before the department decided to take this project to that municipality, was there no study done to say this and that would be impediment in us in the department implementing the project? And I would like to ask, because in Taung, 60 kilometers from Naledi, there's everything you need for the project, where I come from, water and all of that. Actually, Naledi gets water from Taung, because we have a very big dam. Why wouldn't you relocate it to Taung instead of taking it to Maludia for food? But as Honorable Falding has asked, do we stand a chance of getting the project back? And when can that be? Thanks.
Okay, DDG.
Thank you, Chair. Maybe let's start with the Naledi issue. We use this as an example to just flag the typical problems that one encounters on the water side. But fortunately, we are in a much stronger position now, starting in April, funding-wise. So it's not like the project would be completely lost to Naledi. The point is that it is evident that we need to spend vast amounts of money fixing the water problem. And we've had engagements with COGDA in that regard, in terms of which we're saying that once we have identified the problems relating to water that constrain solar water heating rollout, one is able, through the intergovernmental relations framework, to collaborate, in terms of which perhaps the Department of COGDA, through the municipality, can simultaneously initiate a program to fix the water whilst we, so it's like an integrated approach. The other option is for us to capitalize the water, you know, costs in the solar water heater subsidy. So in other words, we could do an assessment of all the water problems in the country, quantify it, and it comes to X amount, well, hundreds of million rands, and then our contribution could be X, and we could perhaps look to other funding from the MIG fund and so on. I think perhaps with the assistance of this kind of forum, this committee could help in making sure that we have coordinated approach to these problems. We're just merely saying that we thought it was an electricity / solar water heating problem. Suddenly it's got elements of water that we need to deal with. So the short answer is that the 4.7 billion rand will resolve a whole lot of these issues relating to Naledi specifically, but other municipalities in general. And this brings me to the question about the feasibility. It says that, you know, in Naledi, it was unfortunate that this was right at the piloting point. So when we encountered the problem, it was because these were the first municipalities that were allocated funding, right? And no preparation had been done to assess whether everything was in place, you know, before we could successfully roll out a so it was part of the learning curve. But with the approach to doing basic assessments everywhere before we do before we do solar water rollout, we'll be able to can anticipate those problems and not create the expectation on the ground and yet not be able to meet it. So I think that's unfortunately part of the learning curve. And then the issue with the fiscal funding, it does not accrue to municipalities only. Schedule 6 goes to municipalities, and there's Schedule 7 that goes to ESCOM, right? So by and large, this is borrowed from the electricity licensing program, where those municipalities that have electricity licenses would fall under Schedule 6 for the electrification program, and those under those that do not have licenses and ESCOM holds the license would fall under Schedule 7. Now, this has since been extended to the energy efficiency and demand side management appropriations. So we have Schedule 6, which is municipalities, and Schedule 7. And it looks now like the solar water heating program will follow exactly the same appropriation route. Now, the point is that when it is on the ESCOM side, it becomes easier through the contracting or the funding agreement that we enter into with ESCOM to direct where the interventions must take place. Whereas on the municipalities, it is the municipality itself. You know, once you have made a decision that it shall be in, for example, the city of Cape Town, you are not able to say the city of Cape Town must install the units in Rondebosch or in, you know, wherever. But it's the municipality itself that determines where they would like to prioritize. And that's where I was raising the issue that depending on your portfolio, you might or might not be able to make the impact from an energy savings perspective. If it's a social program, well and good, but you won't make the appropriate thing. So you need some balance between that portfolio. But we're saying this is not a problem if we make sure that the 4.7 billion from the fiscus is a social program, and then we have a program that is under the standard offer that then deals with the high income segment, because with those two, you would be able to achieve both objectives at the same time. And then whether municipalities will ring fence the funding, well, they're required in terms of the TFM, of the MFMA and the Division of Revenue to make sure that, and even in the contracting framework, that, you know, it's inputs, which is money that we give them, and we contract for certain outputs. So if the money is not ring fenced and it's used for something else, they would have to come and account to yourself. Then the issue about municipalities losing income because of energy efficiency interventions. It's a worldwide a problem, and there are solutions to deal with it. It's called revenue decoupling. Basically, what you do is you would compensate the municipality for the extent to which they have been energy efficient. So, for example, if the municipality loses that billion rand that we heard about today, and it can be correlated to the savings that they have achieved. In other words, it's not just revenue reduction for other reasons. Then one is able, through the tariff, to adjust in order to give, to compensate that municipality. And one would have to go into a little bit more detail around that. But effectively, it's as simple as this, is that if the municipality revenue relative to the cost, right, is high, it is because the municipality is probably buying energy or electricity at the marginal cost of generation, which is B2B. Right? So they are buying coal energy at a certain time. So what you then do is you say, don't buy coal energy, buy solar water heating energy, because solar water heating energy is less. So you then have a reduction in their revenue, but you also have a reduction in their cost of sales by compensating for them. This is it's a very common a way of doing it. But Chair, having said that, I must confess that the framework, which is a regulatory instrument for doing this, is currently under discussion with NERSA in order to make sure that, you know, once the energy efficiency initiative, I mean, there's 49, and there's a whole lot of other, you know, interventions in the energy efficiency space that are definitely going to impact municipalities and their revenues. So that instrument will come into effect around this year in order to make sure, or the intention is to bring it into effect this year in order to deal with that. And then say the issue about co-ops and their participation. I think my colleagues earlier on today did touch on that, and we know expert, you know, from coming from the Department of Energy. But I think there's an aspiration to create jobs policy to, you know, make sure that there is also rural development, given the fact that, you know, this is clearly a program that has a big social a component, and, you know, the complexities around cooperatives and their sustainability, we do not understand completely, but we know that there is a body of work that is being done to make sure that cooperatives, not only for the solar water heating program, I know even on the supply side, renewable energy, wind and solar, PV and whatever, there is, and biomass, there is an effort to try and introduce cooperatives. Thank you, Chair.
Well, thank you very much, PDG. Seems to me that your questions, your answers have been quite satisfactory. And because no one is looking at me, so I'm one of the members. I see Honourable Van Lingen is logging off on the computer, so that means that she is satisfied. Well, let me thank you, Honourable Members. I just want to